Good evening and welcome to the August 16th meeting of the Morro Bay Planning Commission. Let the record reflect that all commissioners are present and the meeting is called to order. And we will begin, as we usually do, with a moment of silence, please. Thank you. And if you could stand and join us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much, and this is the time set aside in the meeting for announcements from the Planning Commission. Do any of the commissioners have announcements this evening? Seeing none, we will move right ahead to public comment. I'd just like to say that we have a discussion item on the agenda tonight that some of you may wish to comment on. You can do so now if you like, or we will open a public comment period at the time of that item. So it's your choice. Pardon? I'm going to open the public comment period now. Anyone who'd like to speak on any topic, please come forward, and we'd love to hear from you.
Good evening. Linda Steggy, Morro Bay. For some time, our elected officials have been ignoring Measure D and granting illegal permits for uses clearly forbidden by law. I believe it's obvious from some of the comments in your staff report that someone has been pressuring staff to try to find ways to legitimize these illegal actions and plans for future illegal actions. The staff report includes statements that just don't make sense to me, such as, quote, the second sentence indicates that it is for illustration only and is thus not binding, although it does help somewhat in trying to define what is meant by the measure. To me, this is just nonsense. Of course the statement's binding. Any literate person understands exactly what's meant here, even though he or she might not like it. The obvious meaning is forbidden uses include but are not limited to new passenger for hire boats, new restaurants, etc. The writers of Measure D may not have been English majors, but their statements are very clear to anyone who wants to understand them. A friend of mine has sent you copies of the original arguments from the election booklet distributed the year that Measure D was enacted. Here is a statement from that document made by Measure D's originators. Quote, Measure D is short, direct, and easily understandable. The opponents know what it means, and they fear it because it takes away their power to give financial favors to their friends. Unquote. Yes, Measure D is clear, but evidently one or more of our elected officials would like to try and con the public into thinking it isn't. Here's another statement from the election booklet, a statement made by Measure D's originators. Quote, although Measure D will stop further commercial development of Coleman Drive and the area north of the T-Pier, people will retain their power at all times to amend Measure D if a development plan good for all the people should be proposed. Unquote. That should be clear enough for anyone to understand. The intent of Measure D, stated by its originators, is to stop further commercial development until a vote of the people says something different. I trust this makes it clear that fishermen cannot build pancake houses to finance their fishing ventures, hotels can't get around the measure by providing slips for fishing boats, and non-conforming use of a site cannot be carried over to a new non-conforming business. In addition, in section 17.24.180 of our Muni Code, Measure D's exact wording is used to define, quote, expressly prohibited, unquote, uses in our commercial and recreational fishing district. It looks to me like the intent of Measure D has already been interpreted and included in our zoning law. Thank you.
Thank you. Did we get your name?
Yes, but I'll say it again. Ms. Steggy.
Thank you very much.
Good evening. My name is Gary Wilbur, and I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak to the Planning Commission, the citizens of Morro Bay. We live at 481 La Jolla Street. The house next to us, 471 La Jolla, recently sold. There was no activity for days when a truck pulled up and unloaded mattresses to sleep 18 people. After brief inquiry, we learned it was to be a so-called sober living facility. No permits were applied for, nor was any notification given to the surrounding residents, because no permits were asked for or granted. Occupancy of a single-family residential housing unit is limited to 6 people. Any more than 6 people require a special use permit and notifications to the neighborhood. None of this was done. My wife and I are not opposed to such facilities if they are bona fide recovery facility with treatment plans and on-site oversight and management. None of this is going to be available there if it goes through. However, sober living facility is a vague and undefined term. Anyone that can put up $650 a month for a room and board can qualify. It is doubtful that background checks are done, criminal history or otherwise. A duck by any other name is still a duck, and a sober living facility without an exact definition is nothing less than a room and board house, and therefore a commercial enterprise, and zoning of that lot does not include commercial enterprise. I call on the Citizens Council, Planning Commission of Morro Bay, to draft a clear and exacting definition of a sober living facility. Transient housing of this nature is an invitation for convicted felons, sex offenders, and other unsavory characters to enter our neighborhoods without background checks. I'd like to point out that uniform building codes save lives, municipal codes save neighborhoods. And in closing, I'd like to say that we are not opposed to recovery facilities that are real, provide needed counseling, physical and psychological services, and provide a path for re-entry into society. We know this from personal experience, and what an asset to the community a re-entry program can be. There is a huge need out there. We do not need boarding houses masquerading as recovery centers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Erica Mai Barnes. I live at 471 La Jolla Street on the other side of this house that was just sold recently. I was just made aware of this, what's going on today. I've been in and out of town for the last couple weeks. I was around when the house was sold, and my son, who's been around, has been seeing a lot of activity at the house, different people showing up, and we were trying to figure out who was actually going to move in. My concern is that the house is only 1,600 square feet, and I don't know how they're going to house 18 people there. There's no parking as there is on our block. There's young families. People drive up and down the street way too fast as it is, and I'm just concerned that there was nothing, no communication, no information about this possible sober living facility. It just concerns me that someone can just slide right in and make this happen. So that's about all I need to say. So concerned. Thank you.
Thank you. Could I get your name again, please?
It's Erica Mai Barnes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else who would like to speak at this time? Okay, seeing none, we'll close public comment, bring it back to council. Are there any would you like to speak to the sober living issue, or this is you have to understand this is brand new to us, so we're a little unprepared.
Certainly, we heard about this from some of the neighbors, and we had some of our staff go out there and check into it. The person that actually purchased the house came in and spoke with staff. There are provisions in state law that allow folks to operate a residential care facility of up to six folks, and you don't have to come into the city to get permits for it. Or if you have, so if it would fall into something like that, then potentially it would be okay. Once you get over six people, though, you're going to either require to have a minor use permit or a conditional use permit if you're going to service more folks than that. And when I spoke with the owner of the 471 La Jolla property, she'd indicated that she's not specifically affiliated with a sober living facility, you know, or corporation or anything. So it didn't seem like that was something that she was going to be able to do in any case. At least that was the conversation that I had with her at the counter. I asked her. I said, "So, is this something that you have elsewhere, or you're working for a company, or what is the solution here?" And her indication was that she did not operate under the umbrella of any recognized company that did that. So she wouldn't be able to do it anyway. It didn't sound like. And that was the indication that I gave her, was what the limitations were from our code standpoint. So, point being is if they are starting to operate that, you should let us know, because it wouldn't be consistent with our code.
So this becomes, it sounds like this becomes at this point a code enforcement issue, that it's not...
Correct. We've become aware of the issue. We've spoken with the property owner. We've laid out what the requirements are. If she's not operating within those parameters, then that would be a code enforcement issue.
Scott, I know that in the county, they have like private enterprises that do these sober recovery houses that are not under the jurisdiction of the county oversight. Do we have anything on the books for oversight on?
Typically, the facilities that are registered with the state of California.
Yeah, but they're not under a code enforcement of the county. That I know for sure.
No, so if you fall, I mean, the parameters that I described for a residential care facility is broad reaching. It's a large umbrella that many different uses can sit underneath. But the limitation there is the number of folks that you can have that are housed within them, and that's six. Before you would need a permit from the city to do anything with them. And oftentimes, depending on what they're doing, they'll be coming in and making, you know, modifications to the home, and it would require building permits and things like that, depending on how they're setting it up. But there's no requirement from the city, a permitting requirement, if it is qualify as a residential care facility and it's housing six or fewer people. It's when you get over the six people that we get permitting authority, and really what you're talking about then is, you know, the comings and goings, parking, traffic, things like that that can be associated with them, so you can add conditions to the project.
It's not like, because it's kind of like a gray area. You're commercializing, like I think one of the speakers says, commercializing a residential area.
We don't have any say in it. It's state requirements. We literally have no ability to regulate if it qualifies as a residential care facility and has under six people.
Scott, do we have requirements for number of bathrooms per occupants, health and code?
Again, they're registered to the state, so it's all following whatever the state requirements are. I don't know what they are. We have no permitting authority. The law's been that way for years. I mean, yeah. You know, it's just we have the ability to regulate once you get over the six. Okay. To have some regulation once you get over six.
Scott, do they have to disclose to us that they're operating a facility like that?
They do not.
They don't.
Okay. What happens normally, what happens is what's happened here. You have a neighborhood that sees, you know, a house that's operating differently than the others, then the issue comes to us, and then we have to verify whether they're operating underneath that umbrella or not. And usually that just involves us reaching out to them. They give us their papers for certification or what have you, and then we follow up through that process and contact the state. And because typically they have, you know, there's a team of folks that oversee it, you know, from the state standpoint, that inspect them and things like that. So,
just to be clear, Scott, for six or less occupants, there's no requirement for any kind of an umbrella organization or therapist or anything like that?
There's just no requirement from a city permitting standpoint. It's allowed by right, in other words.
And with respect to the state, do they impose any restrictions for six or less?
They have lots of restrictions. And it just depends on what the facility is actually doing. Sometimes it could be elderly care. Sometimes it can be for folks that have, mental issues. It can be many different things. That, again, that's why I gave you the large umbrella, because there's a lot of things that fall within it, and it just depends. Mm-hmm. I've seen different types of facilities.
When you spoke to the individual that purchased the house, did they indicate what type of facility they were wanting to run, or?
They indicated to me that they had no affiliation, meaning they weren't operating that, and so I said, well, that wouldn't be allowed to have those number of folks living in the house, and I left it at that. So if the 18 mattresses are being occupied, you should let the city know.
Scott, if they're charging rent, do they have to have a permit of some type with the city to register that they've got a transaction going on?
And potentially, they would have to register a business license. I'd have to look back at our business license code, you know, depending. There's the difference between that and then having a few roommates, you know. I mean, so you can do that, and there's no requirement that you have a business license with the city.
So if they're not operating as a therapeutic facility, then they would fall under the city's regulations, correct?
And what they would be doing is not a residential care facility, and so then they would need to get a permit from us to do whatever they're doing, which they wouldn't have, and which would likely be a use that's potentially inconsistent with the residential zone. You'd be operating a boarding house, which also I think requires a conditional use permit in our code, so. Effectively, that's what you'd be doing. And I believe that does require a use permit in our code.
So then if I can sum up, just to make sure I understand, okay, mm-hmm. at this point, they really have no authorization from either the state or the city to run anything, to have anything there other than a single-family residence?
Correct. Yeah. That's bottom line.
Okay. we're regarding the comment on Measure D, we're definitely going to get into that later on, so I don't think there's any need to respond at this point. We have no presentations this evening, so we move on to item A, the consent calendar, which consists of our current advanced planning list and approval of the minutes from our July 19th meeting. Are there any comments, corrections, objections, questions?
Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I live across the street from that same house, and I just want to ask one final question and then go on. But if they begin to do what they're not supposed to do and have a bigger facility, are we the ones that are supposed to contact you, or is it going to be monitored?
Okay. I'm going to open public comment period again. Okay.
Let's just keep it.
Give us your name.
I thought we were doing
this
same thing.
My
name's Jennifer Scales. So I just was curious, how are we the ones that are supposed to monitor them, or are they going to be monitored once they begin to do whatever they're doing there? I mean, because she has purchased the home, so she's going to...
We would be finding out from the neighborhood if they were operating it in a manner inconsistent with a single-family home.
Okay.
No different than, obviously, she was talking to the neighbors, and it, you know, sounded like it was something that shouldn't be there, and that's how it came to our attention.
Okay.
And, in fact, we went out there and met with the owner and I think inspected the house. So, yeah, walked through it.
Okay. So we just have to wait and see then, I guess?
Well, see, yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to, okay, so I'll close public comment again. And just, you know, it seems to me that you guys are really on top of the situation, you know, that you're aware of it.
I don't feel safe in my residence.
And it seems that the city is willing to respond to whatever, you know, if there is activity going on there that appears to be out of line.
All right.
So what's happened is this issue came up. We looked into it. Investigated it, okay? And in doing so, we're able to talk with the owner. Sometimes that's not always possible immediately. And we did that, and I laid out the parameters, me specifically. I spoke with her personally.
Right.
And laid out what the parameters are if she's operating a residential care facility, if she's doing something else, or if she's has a single-family home and has roommates. Laid all that out. So she has to operate within those parameters, and that's the way it was spelled out. So if she's not doing that, then certainly feel free to give me a call, and we'll follow up.
Okay.
Okay.
I just was kind of wondering what the guidelines were for that. Thank you.
Okay. we'll open public comment again.
Thank you. My name's Margaret Gear. I live at 530 La Jolla. Hi, Scott. My issue with the code enforcement is faith. I don't have faith. If something happened, they would take care of it promptly. I have a notebook. It took me over a year and a half to get a boat moved and a van and a wheelbarrow on top of a van that's still there. Going in their office over and over and over again. So if this happens, we tell them, what are they going to do? What's the time frame? How are you going to get them out? They're living there. What are you going to do? That's what I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll close public comment, bring it back. Do we want to Scott, do you want to respond to that? Or?
So we can only enforce, code enforcement can only enforce ordinances that we have on the books. So somebody's doing something that's not covered in there, sometimes that's not something that's enforceable. Or sometimes it's not an issue with regard to our codes, or sometimes it's an allowed situation, or sometimes it's a gray area type situation. Oftentimes what happens is we have a process. We usually try to reach out, contact the owners, the responsible parties, and find out what they're doing or why they're doing it. We let them know that we've received complaints sometimes and that what they're doing is potentially in violation. And depending on what the violation is, we'll give them an amount of time to rectify it. Oftentimes we work with them on the schedule, depending on what it is and how long they think it'll take them to clean it up or clear it up. I mean, so it's not a one-size-fits-all scenario all the time. So it's a process. And what happens through the process is you get an initial notice, you'll get a second notice, you get a third notice, then we engage the city attorney's office. Or we can issue fines. It just depends what the violation is. But so that's the process.
And I would assume that something that appears to be a health and safety violation would have a fairly high priority.
Correct. And sometimes the requirement, if it's a health, life, and safety issue, is for it to be rectified immediately. And, you know, it just depends. Again, it depends on the severity. It depends what the issue is specifically. You have leaking sewage. You need to fix that now. You know, that's you know, coming out. You know, we've had situations where that's happened, and that needs to be addressed. They need to have a plumber or somebody come out and fix it now. Today. It's not acceptable to leave, you know, raw sewage on the ground. So those types of situations are something that would be addressed immediately. Somebody's got a bunch of junk outside, that's a nuisance issue. Depending on the amount of junk they have out there, and you know, it might be a 10 working day, you know, period, or it might be a 30-day period, depending on what the conversation is or what the level of a violation is. Just depends.
Scott, maybe this is something, since it's a vague issue, it might be something that maybe we could agendize in the future to have a discussion on sober living facilities and how they integrate into the community.
again, you can agenda, I mean, you can certainly add things on the agenda for future discussion if you want. You know, these are things that are regulated by the state of California. We don't really have much other than, you know, those types of things, depending on what it is. Sometimes they're facilities, and then you might, you know, from a conditional use permit standpoint, get to, you know, weigh in on some of those things. It just depends.
The reason why I bring that up is I know for a fact there's a facility that has 14 women living in a three-bedroom house. They put bunk beds. And this is a, in, you know, we had a presentation, and it's a concern that I think that we need, I think it needs discussion, yeah.
I'm wondering how this would fit into, because I mean, I guess this in some way impacts the affordable housing issue as well. So maybe I'm wondering if I think we need information, whether, you know, in terms of what does the state provide? What are the state provisions in this area?
And it's different depending on the type of use. And
right.
And again, a facility might be a commercial facility. You know, I mean, it might be something that's, you know, a larger facility. It's when you have these small ones that, you know, there's that could potentially be located in a neighborhood that, you know, you seem to sometimes issues arise.
Maybe a preliminary step would be to get that the state requirements, you know, for to go to the state code and distribute them for all of us to read so that we kind of get prepared, and then we could come back and decide if we want to agendize that or if we want to fold that into our discussion of affordable housing when we get to the general plan. Is that?
Yeah.
And I can certainly be happy to help locate those if you can point me in the right direction. The only other comment I would make to Ms. Gear, is it Gear? Yeah. The whole issue of what you can and can't park in the front yard has been quite an issue for a while. You know, if you've gotten your water bill this month, you notice there was a survey in it. We've gotten over 700 responses to that survey so far.
Almost 800.
Almost 800, which is a huge response for Morro Bay. And I sense that some of the problems you had with that issue have to do with the fact that there's a long history behind it, you know, and we're addressing it and working to clear all that up with regard to that particular issue. Okay. Any more public comment? Let me just be sure here. If not, then we will close public comment and move on to the consent calendar. Do we have a motion to approve the consent calendar?
I'll move to approve the consent calendar as it is.
Second?
I'll second that.
Thank you. All those in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Motion carries 5-0. Since everybody said aye, I'm not asking for nays. Then we'll move on to item number B, which is our public hearing for this evening. This is case number UP0-439 and CP0-498 concerning a property at 2234 Emerald Circle here in Morro Bay. And I think Joan is going to talk to this.
Thank you, Commissioner Tuft. And good evening, gentlemen. Applicants Claudia and Don Barry are seeking conditional use permit and coastal development permit approval for the construction of a single-family residence at 2234 Emerald Circle in the southern cluster of the Cloisters subdivision. This slide shows the existing 10,869 square foot parcel located on the cul-de-sac towards the southeastern corner of the subdivision. Site plan illustrates the 2,917 square foot residence with a 452 square foot attached garage and an 86 square foot covered front porch. Note the defined entryway as required by the Cloisters design guidelines. floor plan further illustrates the defined entryway and rear patios, as well as the interior courtyard located at the center of the residence, which provides nice protection from the wind here in Morro Bay. The elevations. The design is in compliance with the design guidelines and has been approved by the Cloisters Design Review Committee. These are the north and east elevations. The landscape plan for this project illustrates the designer's focus on native species and drought-tolerant plants, and is, again, in compliance with the design guidelines for landscape plans. So it's staff's recommendation that the Planning Commission adopt Resolution 17-16, which includes the findings and conditions of approval for permit UP0433 and CP0498 for the proposed single-family residence at 2234 Emerald Circle. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for staff from the commission?
I didn't have a chance to look at the cloister design guidelines. When we have something like this where what seems to be a minor face to the house, but it's the major face to Route 1, changes from something that has all this articulation to something that has almost no articulation. What's the cloister's guidelines say about that kind of transition?
I don't believe it will be very visible from Highway 1. There's a large retaining wall in between the home and Highway 1. And tall trees and vegetation. And the rear elevation also has, a nice, there's two patios in the rear. If you can see. And a big trellis structure on that northern patio. So.
I'll hold comment.
Okay.
Question? Other questions? I have one. On page 4 of the staff report, under standards, it lists architectural character, bungalow, craftsman, or Cape Cod character. Could you expand on that a little bit?
I believe the design of this structure most closely resembles the craftsman style, as it has the gently pitched gable roof as opposed to, a steeper incline on the gable roof. It has trellises and patios, large trellises and patios. The defined front entryway, again, with the rock pedestals with the posts, kind of tapered posts, holding up the front entryway there at the porch, as well as natural design elements as far as, the stone cladding there on the bottom portion. You can
see. Right, but what I was asking was the standards require it to be one of these styles. Is that the case, or...? It requires it to be bungalow style, Cape Cod style, or craftsman style?
One would say that until you drove through the neighborhood, at which point I don't know that that's really what's happening out there. It seems like they've taken elements from these and utilized them in the design of the homes that are out there. Some of them follow pretty consistently the architectural style referenced. Some of them have components out there that reference the style. So, I mean, we drove around, looked at all the houses, every single one of them today, and that's what I took away from the drive. And some of them, I don't know, really include much of any of the architectural elements that you would expect to find in those styles. So it's a little interesting. I'll leave it at that. Again, my history here has only been 2 years, so it's a little unclear as to why that's the case, but that's my takeaway from driving through the subdivision.
And then just one more question. I do have one more. Did the Cloisters Design Review Committee make any comments in approving this?
He did not, no, sir. Hmm. It's Exhibit C, I believe. I'm terribly sorry.
Attachment D.
It is
right.
Exhibit D.
Okay. We're going to, I'm going to ask for any ex parte communications regarding this item. Anyone have any ex parte to report? Seeing none, then we'll open this up for public comment. And typically we invite the architect or owner or owner's representative to speak first. Please come forward.
Dr. Teft, can I read you a paragraph in the design guidelines real quick?
Certainly.
Okay, thank you. Under architectural character, it says, although no one particular design style is required, homes with a bungalow, craftsman, or Cape Cod character define the vocabulary which will be allowed in the development. Architectural styles such as modernistic, neoclassical, Tudor, Southwestern, Mediterranean, and Western Ranch are prohibited, which is interesting.
I thought Major D was hard to understand. Okay.
Okay. Good evening, Commissioners. My name is Robert Fisher. I'm the architect and agent for Don and Claudia Berry, the owners. I have no issues with the staff's staff report or any of the conditions for approval. Sounds like you have some questions, though, for me, and or maybe some suggestions as well. So. More than willing to discuss those with you and see what we can come up with here.
Okay. We'll hold our questions till the end of public comment period and see if anyone else wants to comment. But if you could stick around, that'd be great.
I'd further like to comment. I took this project over from at the request of the owners after their initial architect fell ill. He became ill. Couldn't complete the project. So they basically asked me to take the design that he had done and take it through the DRC, the Planning Commission, and on through the Building Department for the for plan check. So I believe it's in character with the houses in the surrounding neighborhood for sure, and that it also that it meets the intent of the design guidelines. But, and again, the city's DRC consultant agreed and approved the design. So that's all I had to say, unless you have some questions for me, or I'd be happy to come back up and discuss it further with you as well. Okay?
Right.
All right.
That'd be great.
Great.
Anyone else who would like to speak on this item, please, we'd love to hear from you.
Betty Winholtz, I'm out at the Cloisters quite a bit, and just the architecture, I don't know of any houses out there that go vertical. They have the horizontal boards, so I'm not sure how that fits in with the style that's referenced in your attachment.
Thank you. Anyone else? Seeing none, we'll close public comment, bring it back to the commission. Are there any questions for the architect?
Mr. Fisher, did the clients consider photovoltaics or rainwater collection or gray water systems or anything that talks about a reality that we have here instead of some?
Yes, I believe the landscape architect has and with the civil engineer, they've considered all the stormwater issues and the drought tolerance stuff and the gray water, and that'll all be incorporated into it. The question I we hadn't gotten that far yet, obviously, and it just sort of came up in my mind just recently here after we'd already submitted the plans was, you know, we're going to be using heat pump systems throughout the house, and it obviously begs for, you know, solar PV cells on the roof. And I just thought to myself, have I seen any photovoltaic?
I think you do.
I think I've seen one. Sure. I saw one, yeah, for sure. Yeah. There may be more, but that was all that I saw.
They're going to tend to face west.
Pardon me?
They're going to tend to face west.
Yeah, here. Right.
So you may not see them.
We've got quite a bit here facing south, but
is it strictly an economic decision to change from the stone and the vertical batten to the stucco?
No, that was the design that was passed on to me, and to be honest with you, I've never seen bungalow or craftsman with that type of a, you know, with the board and bat, the vertical board and bat pattern. So
that's all I have.
Was there any consideration that, let me rephrase, in the design guidelines it talks about not having a continuous plane on the facades facing the streets. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you have two sides of this property that are street frontage.
Mm-hmm.
It's a corner lot. So the longest unarticulated wall in this building is facing essentially your front.
The west.
Front street, your west.
Right.
Was there any consideration in rearranging that facade to allow a little more articulation in that plane?
Not really. No, I just basically took the project over as okay. It was already presented and worked out between the owner and the previous architect.
It seems like that contrasts directly with the design guidelines.
Mm.
Thanks.
Okay.
Other questions?
Richard. There was a house maybe a year ago in the Cloisters area that had issues with due to the nature of building in the dunes there in the mm-hmm. Cloisters that had rotting problems in the foundation, and they had to deal with that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Have you looked into that at all and how to address those?
Well, we haven't gotten that far. Obviously, that's a construction document issue, you know, between, and it's, I mean, we use the building code requirements for distance away from soil. You know, it's 8 inches now. It used to be 6. Now it's 8 inches from concrete to soil.
Yeah, because this particular house, if I'm not mistaken, they had to raise it and deal with that. So due to the nature of where this is at, the
mm-hmm.
Cloisters were always that whole project was a contentious issue there for years, you know, with the height requirements.
Right, raising anything down there is an issue because of the height limitations and constraints.
So I'm just wondering if you looked into that at all.
No.
I certainly don't want to participate in any sort of architectural policing and imposing my particular aesthetics on the house. And, you know, I find it really persuasive that the architectural committee of the community found no problem with it. And, you know, the test for me is usually become whether I find it inherently offensive or objectionable to the community standards. I don't find that here, so I really don't have any objections. Mm.
They made some minor suggestions. One was just about where to end the siding, you know, towards the stucco, and yeah, we made a few changes in that regard. But yeah, that was really all they came up with on their review.
Okay. Thank you.
No.
Any other questions? I have one. I have one question.
Yes, sir.
In your opinion, as an architect, is this an American Craftsman style house?
I grew up in Pasadena, so, it's pretty hard to. Yeah, it's pretty hard to please me, you know. No. It has elements.
Right.
Elements. Yeah.
Okay. So if there's no other questions, we'll end public comment period, bring it back to the commission for discussion. Who would like to start out? Joe? You're kind of
I apologize. I've exhausted my questioning by inserting my opinion when I shouldn't have. But again, I can only restate what I just said. I don't find anything particularly offensive or requiring that we make some sort of changes in the design. I don't have a problem with it.
Okay.
I can't support this project the way it is. It clearly doesn't conform to the architectural review guidelines, or you know, the ARC for the cloisters. I've done work in the cloisters, and when the earlier in the process, this would not have gotten through the ARC for the cloisters, and I don't think it should now. For one thing, you have a street frontage that is the least articulated facade in the whole structure, where the best facade of this whole structure is the one facing the backyard. And if you turn the house around like 180 degrees, I think it'd be a much better project. But so I just don't think it fits the architectural guidelines for the cloister, so I can't support it.
Richard?
I agree with you, Jerry. I think we can do better. That's enough said.
Michael?
Well, I spend a lot of time walking my dogs through the cloisters, so I don't live there. And that's not a retaining wall. That's an 8-foot party wall. There's no retention at that area at all. It goes up pretty far to Route 1, but you see down into the area because of the cul-de-sac pretty easily. And that corner is not as problematic as the elevations make it look. It's really only the bathroom wing that's got the stucco. When you look at the elevations, it looks like the whole east facade would be stucco, which is what I was concerned about. But I do think Commissioner Allure is right. The primary west facade there that most of the neighbors will see is really kind of underwhelming, and it's just two bathrooms there at the center where the peak goes up. So you've got your articulation going up, making it look like it's going to be a major piece, and then it's got two tiny bathroom windows that everybody's going to know are bathroom windows. And I don't know, it's kind of underwhelming. I love the idea of a courtyard house. We don't see that very often. I think it's a fantastic kind of typology. When you think about most of our houses are massing and don't really have much thought about quality of light and things like that. But this is actually very progressive in terms of some of that aspect of it. But the west facade, I think, just really needs one more tweak. I would agree with Commissioner Laura on that part. I'll never understand the idea of the stone. The vertical board and bat is a very traditional mode, but the little wainscot of stone, I think, is not necessary, but I'm not going to worry about that. It's the massing on the west that I think is the primary problem.
Well, I'm going to agree with Commissioner Allure in terms of the layout of the house looks very nice, particularly the courtyard. But the exterior, I mean, if this is being represented as a craftsman style house, it clearly is not. Okay, the whole shape of the building is not craftsman. And it lacks almost every feature of a craftsman house. Craftsman houses have prominent porches, oftentimes across the full length of the house, usually raised 2 or 3 steps from the sidewalk. The pillars that they're showing here, which are a characteristic of craftsman houses, typically craftsman houses are tapered square pillars, whereas these look like Doric columns that would go on to a colonial design. The roof line of a craftsman house typically has multiple vertical levels that create interest. There are no features such as exposed rafters or decorative knee braces, which are typical of a craftsman house. So, I mean, it just And when you look at the design, you go, this is a ranch house with some craftsman stuff stuck on it, to be brutal about it. So I have objections to it as being represented as being a craftsman style house. I'm also from the Glendale, Pasadena area. I've spent many very enjoyable afternoons at the Gamble House. This is not that. The other thing I object to is kind of plays off some another theme that's been brought up is the fact that our design guidelines require a similar architectural treatment on all sides of the house, and what we have here is fairly interesting treatment on, or at least an articulated treatment on two sides, and then two flat walls. And to me, that does not meet our design guidelines. So I also am not going to be able to support the project as it currently exists. And as to the neighborhood, you know, I don't think this commission can be responsible for decisions that have been made in the past, good ones or bad ones. You know, all we can deal with is the project that we have in front of us and the codes and the design guidelines that are currently in force. I can't say, well, it's kind of like everybody else is doing it. I can't go along with that, you know, rationale for approving it.
Just to be clear, though, the guidelines of the cloisters do not require that it be formally designed as a craftsman house, but only to borrow various architectural elements from a menu of a variety of styles. And it's really left to them to combine it in any way they choose, as long as it's tasteful and acceptable.
Yes, and the expression of that is seen throughout the subdivision. I literally drove around and looked at every single house today, and many of them, a majority of them, do things that are similar but in different ways that this is doing, and it's they're pieces of architectural styles that are referenced in the document, but not full-blown design. Some of them are. I won't say that there aren't some. Some are, but there are a lot of them that are not. That are different. There are architectural styles that are sort of mixed and matched a little bit.
Well, right. And I would agree with Chairman Teft that if, in quotes, a mistake has been made in the past, it's not a justification for replicating it now or in the future. But I would question, you know, whether that architectural hodgepodge is really a mistake by the guidelines of the cloister.
Oh, I don't think it's a mistake. It's not a mistake. Not with the prevalence that's out there. It's something that was done purposely. I mean, I think the idea was you don't have to have a specific style, but these are the styles we'd like you to emulate in your design. And they've done that. They've taken those architectural styles, pieces of it, and incorporated them into design and into many of the homes out there. But, you know, there's quite a few of them that aren't entirely one style or another.
But I'm not clear. Honestly, I'm not clear where those incorporated elements are in this design. I mean, I don't see there is. I mean, there is no front porch. There's a covered entryway. You know, there are no exposed beams. There are no decorative knee braces. I mean, they're just not there. So I mean.
I'm not arguing the fact. I'm just telling you what I saw when I went out there. In fact, I mean, we had the conversation in the car. Joan was with me. I was like, this is interesting. I mean, it's not what I've been through this subdivision many times. I guess I just didn't pay as close of attention as I did when I drove around through it today. And I was like, wow, it's prevalent. It's everywhere. It wasn't just on that couple of houses that I saw that were right here. Because when this application was submitted, I drove over to the cul-de-sac there and drove around it just to kind of check out what was over there, because we don't have a lot of vacant lots in the subdivision. But today we drove around, looked at every single house in the subdivision, and I was kind of like, wow, that's interesting. I didn't realize it was like that, I guess. It just didn't occur to me originally. That's all.
But there are designs which are more successful. In other words, there are. I mean, even right in the immediate vicinity, even in these photos that are in, you know, mm-hmm. that were submitted, there are some that you look at them and you go, "That's referencing the Craftsman style."
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't see that here.
I mean, I think you've given direction. It seems like, I mean, a majority of you felt similarly, and I think you gave direction about the west wall. I mean, the architect's here. You can certainly have him come up and see if he desires, you know, additional input from the commission so that he can make alterations and bring something back to you. I guess I shouldn't assume. I was assuming maybe that you would continue the item and with direction and might be worthwhile talking with him. I don't know.
Yeah, I have one more comment I'd like to make before that. Given all of this, I also am not sure that it's possible to design a house that truly references the Craftsman style that is this large an area with only 14 feet of height. I'm not sure that that can be done. The one way it might be able to be done would be to reference the Prairie School of American Craftsman Design, which is much more horizontal and doesn't have the gables and some of the other features that is in the kind of Pasadena Craftsman style. So
you see the issue in other homes designs that are out there. Similarly, the height is an issue to bring those forward. And again, that's, I think, the section that Joan read you earlier was perfect. It says you don't have to go with one or the other. These are the recommended styles, and clearly they took that to heart out there in that subdivision.
You know, Scott, I, like I said, I think it could be done better. You know, maybe even stucco, maybe more overhang. You know, we can get into semantics mm-hmm. about like Craftsman or whatever, but I don't want to be rude, but it looks trackish. You know what I mean? It looks like it's a house that is maybe not in. Fit in the neighborhood. You know?
I mean, that's fine. All I was suggesting is that maybe you have the architect come up here to make sure he's taken enough away from you so he can go revise the design. I mean, my recommendation to you would not be to deny the project, would be to continue it and to allow them to redesign it,
yeah.
Consistent with input from the commission. I just want to make sure that the architect
has
enough input, or maybe has a couple questions for you that might help bring back a better design. That's all that I was really trying to get at.
I think Chairman Teff brought up like a little bit more of a porch, you know, a little bit. I don't particularly care for the vertical, you know, maybe it's stucco, but you know, I don't like, but I'm open, you know, but it just it's something, you know.
Okay, so we'll open if everyone agrees, we'll open it up for public comment to allow the architect to come back and kind of interact with us.
First, I'm not offended by your comments because I can honestly tell you I was not the designer.
Yeah.
I was the architect that took over the project from another architect. The configuration, you know, the massing, it's a problem. I've done a couple of houses out of the cloisters years ago, and I know what you're talking about. The problem out there with the height configuration, you have to break the spans. There's only so far you can span at a certain pitch. So you've got to, you know, your gables have got to run a lot of different directions to make it work. And I've done a house pretty large. It was pretty good size out there. And one of the two stories as well, one of the Cape Cod ones. And, there's a lot could be done here. I just have to take it back to the owner and see if they're willing to, you know, not go back to, well, maybe not square one, but go back pretty far into the process. Yeah, you know, they worked on this for quite a while with the previous architect, and I did not make any adjustments to it because this is what they wanted. So I don't want to throw him under the bus, the other guy, but, you know, this is not what I would consider bungalow or craftsman either.
you know, I too like the courtyard.
That's
cool.
That's it. That's about the only redeeming. But yeah, you're right. The western elevation. Yeah, it looks to me like what they just went right to the setbacks, basically. But in order to do the courtyard, I think it pushed it toward the hip roofs. And once you get into the hip roofs, what do you do? You know, with the you have to start creating gable ends, and the bay windows too. You know, the 45 degree bay windows. So, the front porch. I agree.
The overhang.
It's not much.
Sense is the front porch is under-detailed, the roofs are under-detailed. It's not the massing. You can't do much with the massing because without going back to the footprint.
Yeah.
But I think the window fenestration on the west and the pattern of window trim and the relationship with that gable that it's over the bathroom windows. I think
how to do all those things. So I'm fully aware of all that. Actually, it's kind of interesting. This particular house is the same house, basically, that was approved with a previous owner years ago. And the owner passed away the day he picked up the building permit.
Oh, my gosh.
And it what was the style on that one? It was more of a Mediterranean or something, wasn't it? Yeah, it wasn't either or.
It was very much Mediterranean style.
Yeah, it was very nice, but it was basically the same configuration. It had the courtyard in the center, the garage was in the same location, the entry, everything. So, I'm open to suggestions, whatever you would like to do. I just have to take it back to the owners.
There's two one-story houses across the street to the south that are shown on these images. And I would just say that the main difference between this and those is the nature of the articulation around the roof edge and the nature of the articulation around the windows and the trim. Mm-hmm. And those are highly contrasting ones, whereas this one's very regular and takes away. What you actually want to do, I think, is accentuate the eccentricities and get away from the consistent vertical rhythm. And I think you'll probably find it punches a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And it could be the color being very monotone hurts that as well if you got into a mix of the two tones, because it would be a really expensive deal to go back and start tweaking the plan to any great extent.
I'm afraid it would.
But I think you're within a couple inches of tweaking surface area that you can probably make the articulation stronger than it looks.
Yeah, there's a perfect place on the west elevation to articulate that with where the double bathrooms are. Push the rest of it back. And you have to push back the garage. You've got to push back in some of the rooms, the courtyard. Yeah, it just basically affects the whole floor plan when you do that.
I think I guess my comment in terms of the architecture was it just needs to have integrity. You know what I'm saying? And to me, this doesn't have integrity. It is a house which is basically not a craftsman house in terms of its form, with some craftsman stuff stuck on it. And it has the feel of that. You know, that's how it comes across. And whatever style is consistent with the cloister's guidelines, I'm not married to the craftsman style necessarily, but I would like to see it kind of be true to itself.
Sure, I understand. Okay. Okay.
So
I guess I'll make a motion here that we move to continue UPO 439 and CPO 498 at 2234 Emerald Circle to a date uncertain. To continue it.
Second.
We have a motion. We have a second. Do we have any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, call for the question, please.
Commissioner Lucas?
Aye.
Commissioner Stavsky?
Aye.
Commissioner Luhr?
Yes.
Commissioner Ingraffia?
Yes.
And Chairman Tuft?
Yes.
Okay. Motion passes 5-0.
Okay. So we're only at 7 o'clock. Are we good to keep going? Yeah. Good. Okay. So then we will move on. As soon as I pull my agenda out here. We'll move on to new business, which is Section C, Item C1, which is a discussion of Measure D. I would just like to start out by saying that I would consider this probably a preliminary discussion on Measure D and one that will no doubt continue and involve the Harbor Board and the City Council, and you know, but this is sort of getting the ball rolling. With that, there we go. I think Scott will be giving us a brief kickoff staff report.
Thank you, Chair Teft, members of the Commission. This item comes to you it was placed on the agenda, I think, back in July as a future agenda item by the Planning Commission for discussion, really to have a discussion about maybe better defining it if that's possible or you know, determining what's allowed in the Measure D area versus what's not. Because it often comes up, it's often, you know, as pointed out by previous speakers, a point of contention that's out there. So probably a good topic worth discussion. We have a guest today. We have Eric Endersby, the Harbor Director. He agreed graciously to join us as well, since he has a lot of experience with Measure D and he runs all the lease sites down there. So he has to deal with it on almost probably a daily basis. So moving to the presentation. So Measure D was approved by the voters back on June 2nd of 1981. There's a picture of the actual ballot that was voted on back then. You all have copies of that. Some background, I'm going to go more recent background. Starting back in 2008, the council placed Measure D on the November ballot, discussed placing it on the November ballot with the intent to repeal or amend the measure. The City Council instead at that time chose to delay that decision and directed staff to pursue additional stakeholder input because they couldn't make up their mind, I think, exactly what they wanted to do at the time. And so they thought more input would be valuable and hopefully lead to a more straightforward decision on better defining what was meant or allowed in the Measure D area. In looking back through the history, it doesn't look like it ever came back to council after that direction was given, although it's a little unclear. I mean, I kind of researched through the agendas and stuff and didn't see anything in there for it, so not sure what happened back then exactly. I do know in 2013, it popped back up on the radar. There was a joint City Council Planning Commission meeting on April 23rd. Where the issue was discussed, also where the City Council and Planning Commission reaffirmed the intent was to preserve the Measure D area for commercial fishing industry interests, and that we would be good to better define it even back then. And the direction was given to, again, seek stakeholder input on that area, and that the Planning Commission review that input and then provide recommendations to City Council. It looks like that didn't happen exactly like that. Instead, it was processed. They said the Harbor Advisory Board took a look at it back on in September of 2013. The HAB at that time was also interested in developing better definitions to help clarify what was meant by the measure, and the HAB provided recommendations moving forward to, again, develop a definition for passenger for hire and sport fishing vessels, and then to urge the council to be conservative in their interpretation of what is allowed in the Measure D area. Those recommendations never did make their way all the way back to council, although it was close. I think Mr. Endersby sitting next to me drafted a staff report, and it was agendized but later taken off the agenda and didn't resurface back at a council meeting. So this is something it's been on the radar for a while. We've been talking about it for a while, and so it's probably, again, appropriate to take it up now. Again, back in July of 2016, the Planning Commission identified this as a future agenda item. Specifically, the concern was noted that we need to better define this so as to avoid some of the contention that we have associated with, lease site development and so forth that we've had in the recent past anyway, since I've been here. Measure D, the intent appears to be develop uses within the Tidelands Trust lease site area between Beach Street and Target Rock. Limit those to the uses predominantly catering to licensed commercial fishing operations or non-commercial recreational fishing activities. The specific language of it is basically broken down into two sentences. You have the first sentence, which is the operative sentence, and it says that the city shall not grant any permit, authorization, or other approval of any state-owned tidelands subject to city lease between Beach Street and Target Rock unless such development or use is primarily for the purposes of serving or facilitating licensed commercial fishing activities or non-commercial recreational fishing activities, or is clearly incidental thereto. The second one starts off with the illustrative comment, and in my staff report, you noted the previous speaker this evening, there's a non-binding section because it has that illustrative purpose in front of it. I think it does provide direction, though, and is useful in determining what we can and cannot do out there, but probably also needs additional definition to help us out with that. Again, I'll read it. For the purposes of illustration only and not by way of limitation, no approval shall be granted for any new passenger for hire boats or supporting facilities or any new restaurant, cafe, gift shop, or other retail establishment serving the general public. And any existing such uses shall hereinafter be considered nonconforming and shall not be expanded or enlarged. This leads us sort of into the question portion of Measure D, and that the Commission did not, again, initially identify specifics about what clarification was sought, but really just to place on the agenda for discussion purposes. Given that I didn't really have any questions to start with, I utilized a document that Dr. Teff gave me that raised some issues and some questions, and you have those in your staff report. I thought it was, at least, if nothing else, would serve as a starting point to generate discussion, because I think you need that. And certainly you have the ability to discuss some related to the specific questions or come up with your own, what have you. It's entirely up to the commission. I do have them in the presentation here, and you have them in your packet. The first question, I'll just briefly touch on each one. I'm not going to read each one of them. It says, in the phase of licensed commercial fishing activities or non-commercial recreational fishing activities, does the adjective talking about licensed apply only to the commercial fishing activities, or does it apply to non-commercial recreational fishing activities? And it goes on to give you a couple of examples of the use. Question two deals with the concept of the serving or facilitating of commercial fishing activities. And question three speaks to
the word predominantly.
Yeah, the word predominantly. I appear to have. I had another piece in here that I omitted. I apologize. And then you have question four, dealt with the fact that Measure D does not include language that restricts its impacts to only approvals required for new development. It's hard for me to read from here.
It has to do with the phrase for purposes of illustration only and what the impact of that is.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
And the last question deals with the statement that no approval shall be granted for any new passenger for hire boats or supporting facilities. And then goes on to talk about the restaurants, cafes, no gift shops, or the retail establishments. And then ask what that statement for the purpose of illustration only means, and what effect that has on the overall that overall section, that second section that was discussed. Again, so this is really for the Planning Commission to have discussion on, and so really for you to verbalize what your concerns are as it relates to Measure D. Those would be, that would be good input to get. What is your concerns? Where have you seen that it's, that in your opinions, that it hasn't been applied accurately or appropriately, or where you have questions whether it's been? I mean, maybe more to the point, you questioning whether that was an appropriate use that was allowed to go in there or not, those types of things. And then hopefully at the end, maybe we can get a little direction as to what you'd like to see brought back, sort of keeping in mind that discussion and resolution to Measure D is not something that's in our work program, meaning ours, mine, or yours, and so isn't something that's probably going to be able to spend a whole lot of time on as a result of that. We do have a goal-setting process that we go through, and we identify a work program that goes along with implementation of objectives. And again, this is not on that. So what I propose to do to take out of this process, and hopefully the input that we get here this evening, would be to funnel this into our general plan and LCP update process, because it seems like a good place to put it. And we're getting a lot of input just in general for things that we're doing, including the downtown waterfront strategic planning process. It seems like that might help, to add something to this discussion as well. An alternative to that would be we bring this back for the goals and objectives for fiscal year 17-18. And with that, if there's questions or comments or what have you, I'd be happy to answer them. But that's the end of my presentation.
Well, but in addition to that, Scott, I mean, this is really not about what Measure D should say or how it should be changed. There's real questions in my mind as to how it should be applied in the interim. In other words, what does that language actually mean, which is kind of what I was getting at.
Agreed, yeah. No, I think that was the issue why it was placed on the future agenda item, was what does it mean? And I think that concern was sort of generated from looking at what's out there and saying how is it there, and looking at some of the approvals that have come in the past and even more recently, and saying how did we do that or why did we do that? I think it's certainly an item worth discussion for sure. And it tends to, when it's discussed, generate interest. So
I guess maybe the questions that I gave you were not in any particular order. They were not in order of most important to least important or anything like that. If I could suggest, to me, one of the most important issues is what constitutes new versus existing, because does it make any difference? Because the text of Measure D does not say in the first sentence, okay, which is really the strong sentence, does not say new. Okay, it says the city shall not grant any permit, authorization, or other approval unless such development or use is primarily for the purposes of serving or facilitating, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, that says you can't grandfather these things. If someone comes in for a new permit on an existing site, okay, you can't grant that unless the uses are conforming to Measure D. So the fact that there was a restaurant there before, just reading the language of it, We said we were going to have public comment on this, and I think now is the time that we have public comment, please. I apologize. We kind of get carried away sometimes. So I would like at this point to open it up for public comment. Please, anyone who would like to speak on this issue, come forward. We'd love to hear from you. We'll see how it goes.
Good evening. My name is Joseph Kinchelos. I'm a commercial fisherman here in Morro Bay. I'm also the vice president of the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization. As far as your language for Measure D, I think it pretty much, it's really pretty simple. It boils down to a couple things. If you don't catch fish, sell fish, or buy fish, or help people catch fish or buy fish, you don't fall within the parameters. It's really pretty simple. Measure D was put in place to protect the commercial fishing community and help us grow. And we've shown we've been doing that very much over the last 9 years. 2007 was a bad year. We've been on a good upswing. It's a good thing, and it needs to be left exactly the way it is. Thank you.
Betty Winholtz, I would just add to that that it was written by, and the proponents of Measure D were both commercial fishermen. And so obviously the intent there was to do exactly what the previous speaker said. And in fact, in the mood of that time, it wasn't to promote it, it was to keep it from going under because people were wanting to develop it. And so it was a protective measure, and it passed by 55% of the general populace, which I think is a good sum of people. And so I guess I just hope that you won't think that you can interpret something that's pretty clear, because I don't know how you can interpret something that was made by the vote of the people. So if you want it to say something different, it seems like it would have to go back to the vote of the people. There's one other point that I wanted to make. It was about the illustrative sentence. I thought that was put in there, and because they used the word "and not limited to," they were giving not just examples, but they were saying not, but that this is not the end of the list. But you get the idea from our list that these are the kinds of things that we're looking at. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good evening. Erica Crawford, Chamber of Commerce. Just very briefly, we're interested in this conversation. We're watching this discussion. We're very interested because commercial fishing boats represent more than 80, maybe more than 120 small businesses is the way we're looking at it. So very in tune with this conversation. We'll track it all the way through. Thank you.
Good evening, Nancy Bast. It seems to me, in order to judge this issue fairly, we need some background and to understand the circumstances and intent of the original initiative voted on in 1981. Circumstances that have not really changed, except probably have worsened. Morro Bay is the only port of refuge for the 135 nautical miles between Santa Barbara and Morro Bay. For a heavy displacement commercial fishing boat, typically going 6 or 7 knots per hour, and if Morro Bay did not have accommodations for a fishing fleet, it would be a full day's running, and in heavy weather, it'd be 2 days running to get somewhere to rest, to get repaired, unload, refuel, and resupply. Our waterfront is not in the not-so-distant past, had many places a fish boat could tie up that are now restaurants, gift shops, and yacht berths. The people of California own the tidelands through the State Tidelands Trust. The State Lands Commission gave the city of Morro Bay as trustee the administration of our harbor shoreline to lease the waterfront for the revenue that comes to the city. It is well known that visitor-serving leases provide the city more revenue than fish boat docks and services. Still, the fishing industry is a major asset to Morro Bay, not all of whose financial benefits can be directly tallied in dollars. But indirectly, its benefit to this town and to society as a whole is incalculable. In products, in colorful interest, in representing a freedom working with nature that nourishes the spirit. very wisely, state lands law gives first priority for waterfront use to water-dependent commerce, such as commercial fishing boats and their necessary ancillary services. Restaurants and shops are way down in priority, and hotels are the last on the list. Believe it or not, Newport Beach, California was once a fishing port with canneries and a haul-out ways. If that is the vision you want for Morro Bay, continue to find ways to misinterpret Measure D. If that is what the people of Morro Bay want, put it on the ballot so that the people can repeal it if that's what they want. Otherwise, abide by the law in the strictest sense of Measure D, as it was clearly intended by the authors and by the people who overwhelmingly voted for it. Thank you.
Take your time.
My name is Bob Meharry. I'm a commercial fisherman here in Morro Bay 40 years. I'm a board of director of our local association. My wife's grandfather wrote Measure D, Joe Giannini Sr., so I know a little bit about it. It's working pretty good. You know, it's working pretty good. I don't really quite understand. I know there's some vague things the way it's written, but if you look overall at the waterfront, it's working pretty good. You know, we still got our spot in the lineup at the wharf. We've got some new families starting fishing-related business. Whether it's right to the I and the T, I don't know, and I don't care. They're buying fish. They're providing jobs, fishing-related. Maybe they got to sell a fish taco to make ends meet, but they're selling a fish taco, not a pancake. Okay? So, you know, are we making a bigger deal about something that doesn't need to be made a big deal about? I know you guys need it. I know you need it in black and white. You have a job to do. But I also know there's been some hoopla lately. But it's working pretty good. I'm one of the older guys. I'm not born and raised here. But I've been, you know, this is where I raised my family. And I know what Joe Giannini wanted. I ain't blood, but, you know, I carry the caskets at the family funeral, okay? I know what he wanted. And I know what his son wanted, Jody, okay? It's working pretty goddamn good. So don't let everybody freak you out, okay? That's all I ask. And I don't know all the formalities or how this works, and I apologize if I strayed out of the red and green lines or something, but I really think that you put this to ballot, to vote, we're going to lose it because there's been a political change in the climate of the city of Morro Bay over the last few years, and it's not fishing friendly. So I'm scared to death that's going to happen because of just some of the local chaos that's been going on lately with this issue. I'm scared to death. We lose that, we're done. Okay, I don't want to move to Crescent City. I had that opportunity. Okay. I work out of Fisherman's Wharf when I have to. It's a nightmare. Both my sons fish in the tradition of their family. Okay? We lose Measure D or we get so... You got to have new blood. That party boat landing down there, that's been there since the 50s. Maybe they built new docks and they got a lot of shiny new boats. But there's local kids working there. It's jobs. Not everybody's going to go to Cal Poly and get a big-time job, okay? Everything from Beach Street that way, yeah, it's been tweaked a little. There's been some tit-for-tat. Yeah, we got paddleboard rentals. We got a new fish dock because the man that's got the paddleboard rentals was cool enough to help make that happen. So I don't want to go too long. I think you get my point. The flip side of it is, you got any questions? I'm a fisherman. What do you want to know? I got no private agenda. I don't own any of those businesses. I just unload there. You know, can I help you out? You know, if down the road you want to know, the boat's the Maureen. I park right across the street from the French Bakery. I'm on dry dock and Avila. I'll be back in a week. I think a lot of it, communication goes a long way. You're only going to do so much in a room like this. Okay? Door's open. I'd like to help out. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lori French. I'm the wife and mother of a commercial fisherman. My father-in-law moved up here in 1958, and he was from Newport for the reasons that Measure D did not protect. Newport turned into anti-commercial fishing. Measure D is very important to us as a fishing family and for the young blood that's coming into this town. Again, we're like Bob. We have the Nadine and the Longosta. My brother-in-law has the Nadine. We have the Longosta. We're getting older. Our sons are thinking about taking over the boat. And we want to preserve it for them. And that's what I have to say. It's very important. And if you need questions answered, contact us. The name French, it's pretty recognizable in town. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
My name is George League, businessman on the waterfront. Gosh, I've been around here a long time down there, and I seen when Measure D came in, we all agreed that the fishermen did have a point of protecting their area because at the time, the fishing fleet was very strong, and it was needed to protect that area. Since then, things have changed a lot, and I've already been behind the fishermen trying to keep Measure D intact. But it seems like, and just till lately now, that people have stepped up and paid attention that this is the violations that's been going on down there. You can't blame too much on the people that have been violating it because the city themselves are the problem. They allowed it. They allowed people to go down there and do things against Measure D. They're the guilty ones, not the businessmen that went down there and went to work. But the city themselves are the one that allowed this. It's pretty obvious what it says in there. And you're right. If you want to get rid of Measure D, you're going to have to bring it up to the public. And I do believe that the public will back the fishermen again. We are supposed to be a fishing village. One time I told one of the mayors that it got so bad, our fishing fleet got so bad, that we were going to have to buy boats and tie them up at the docks so we'd look like a fishing county town. But they're making a real comeback here now. They're doing a good job, and there are some people down there that are working hard to bring the fishing fleet back into this area. And I think if the facility is kept up for these fishermen, I think more and more fishermen will come into the area. This is my idea. And like I said, you can't blame these people down there that have started businesses. I mean, there's really a lot of violations. But you're either going to have to do one or two things here, and you know it. You're either going to have to bring it forth to the public to vote on it, or you're going to have to enforce it. And that's the bottom line right there.
Thank you. Anyone else that would like to speak at this point?
I just got one more thing to say real quick, if I may. I
Joseph Conchellis again, commercial fisherman. You know, the timeline on this is kind of horrible. I appreciate all the people who came out here to speak to this tonight, and this is an important issue to them. But, I mean, it's August. The majority of our fleet, especially a majority of our politically active fleet, the people who come to meetings and talk, are out of town. So there was another slide that had this as a, you know, take in recommendations, whatever, for future consideration for amendments or anything like that. It'd be really nice if, you know, if you guys are serious about really taking a look at Measure D, if you could maybe put it at another meeting when we have a majority of the fleet home. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, anyone else? Anyone who would like to speak? Okay, then I'm going to close comment.
Can you repeat that one more time?
I'm sorry.
I apologize.
Hello, Neil Maloney, Morro Bay Oyster Company. I'm also in support of Measure D, and I'm the newest leaseholder in Measure D. The city just approved our lease recently, and with that, as George was speaking to, a list of uses that are permitted. And before I bought this building, this property we were using as a nursery, a hatchery to grow baby oysters and shuttle them out to the farm. Right now, our intentions are for this building to be a solution to a problem we have. When it rains 0.4 inches, I get closed for 12 days. And this building will allow us to house tanks where we can hold oysters in there to sell. The point of that being is it's part of our business as an oyster farm's growth. We used to just do all this out on the barge. When it rained, I'd be closed for 120 days a year, zero cash flow. Not a lot of businesses can survive like that. We'd have to lay off a lot of people. With this building, right now we've got 8 employees, had 10, had to fire 2. It's a different story. But we intend to have, you know, 10 to 15 employees full-time, and that's what this building will allow us to do. The other thing is, you know, we grow these oysters, and we need to sell them. So within the uses, I understand, maybe it's conflicting to have retail, but, you know, we're a marine use or a commercial fishing use. We're growing a product out of the ocean. And the way that we see it, I feel like I'm conforming to Measure D is if I'm then allowed to sell it to the public and have an educational aspect and a list of other things that we could benefit the city with. So that's my 2 cents, but I look forward to the rest of this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. Seeing none, we'll close public comment, bring it back to the commission. I guess I'd just like to respond a little bit to the public comment, and this is totally unprepared, but, you know, I just want... I don't think there's any question in this commission about being supportive of Measure D. The problem is it's not, in many cases, it's not clear exactly what Measure D means. And so, you know, I hear people talking about there's been violations of Measure D. So to me, that means that different people are interpreting it in different ways. And obviously, the city was misinterpreting it different, or was interpreting it differently from Mr. League at that point. So the idea here is the basic idea again is not to make a change in Measure D. It's to try and be consistent. You know, because when you have language which is open to interpretation, and it is open to interpretation, I'm sorry, you know, there's things in here which are not clear on the face of them. And in my opinion, it's always better to look at it in advance than to look at it case by case, so that everybody gets the same treatment, gets the same answers from the city as everybody else. So that's what we're trying to do here, I think. We're not really looking to change things. We're certainly not looking to undermine Measure D. We're trying to figure out what we can do to make it applied evenly to everyone who comes before the city. That's all.
I'd just like to add a little bit to that, too. You know, as a son of a fisherman, as a commercial fisherman in a prior life, you know, I think, and I hope to speak for the rest of the commission, planning commission, but what we're trying to do is to continue the heritage of the fishing community that exists here, and to make it so it can get through the hard times and have a place in the harbor that it can grow from. Because right now, we've had some real problems with fish habitat, and at this point, it's starting to regenerate and it's starting to renew. And I think we're starting to get a little bit better response to the in the fishing community. And so I don't think anybody here is trying to eliminate Measure D or to restrict it, but I think we're trying to make it so it better serves the fishing community at present and into the future. And I'll let them speak for themselves, but that's what I'm trying to do here. And so I think with the clarifications that we get, that we can work to, that will help Morro Bay stay a fishing community and drive, which also helps it as a tourist community, and that's what brings the people here, is because it is an actual fishing village and a fishing community.
I respectfully disagree with you, Dr. Teft, on this. It's pretty clear to me as far as what the Measure D says and what its intent was. But bringing it back, if we look at the spirit of the measure, it was to protect the commercial fishing industry. The California, as a state republic, entitled the California State Lands Commission for these tidelands grants. And we, in the city, have a, we're entrusted as a trustee. And we have a fiduciary duty. It's kind of like if somebody is left as a trustee to a trust in a family. And we must, when we have that level of duty, we must always err on the side of caution. And I feel that with the tidelands grants being given to the city, the balance, the whole Measure D, I look at it as a balance. And the balance is such that it's pretty clear that everything north of Beach Street and needs to be directed toward the fishing industry. Now, I've spoken many times on the state of our ocean and the state of the ocean acidification and hypoxia, the state of emergency that we are in right now. And this, the fishing community is affected by it, not only from, you know, economics, but, you know, with the malic acid and all this stuff. And one of the speakers mentioned, as far as an education part of it, I look at that as a benefit. And the benefit of being a safe harbor, the benefit of being a, you know, we don't have to brand ourselves. This is who we are. We are a fishing community, and then we balance it out that way. So I believe it's pretty clear that we need to always err on the side of caution with respect to any of the language.
I guess the only points I'll make is
you look at what's real, we used to have these volcanoes around here that blew all this ash everywhere, and you know, it's the most incredible soil almost in the world, and we pave it over for box stores down the valley from us. And so here we've got a harbor, and we've got fish, and it's a unique opportunity. As a lot of our commentators said, this is one of the few places this can happen. And I think it would be a real mistake to lose that opportunity that's here. I'm not nostalgic. I'm kind of a realist. I think the boats we have are the most beautiful things in the city. They're better than any of the buildings we see coming before us usually. Because they perform so beautifully. And when someone comes in and walks the harbor and they get to that part of the waterfront where they see the real fishing boats, it's different. And I think it represents something that's not wanting to be nostalgic about the past. It represents something that's now and an opportunity in the future. And if we close our doors on that in any way, I think it would be a huge mistake. Because I think the town requires us to be more careful with taking care of the real things that we have, the water quality, the quality of the beach, the quality of the bay, the quality of the ocean life that Commissioner Sadowski was talking about, and the quality of the commercial operations we can have here that are so unique. I used to live in Baltimore on the waterfront, and the tugboats parked about a block away from me, and you'd hear them coming and going with their foghorns and things like that, and the railroad cars would take things down to the industrial part of the waterfront, and that's all gone now. It's all boats and I think the last city pier that I think in the TV show Homicide they used as the headquarters is going to go to a hotel now too, and it was the last major commercial piece that they had left on the waterfront. So I think it's terribly important to look at that word primarily. That to me is what everything hinges around, primarily. Didn't say exclusive, said primarily. And you know, we've had some beautiful testimony here from the shellfish production. Is that fish? Well, I think it probably fits within that setup that we've got there. You know, do you have to have a boat? Probably seems pretty good if we've got capacity to have a fishing boat there, to give it to a fishing boat instead of something else. So I like the reality that Dee addressed, which was we've got it, let's try to keep it. It seems to be viable, and that primarily is the key word, I think, that's there.
Well, I agree with what you're saying generally, okay? The problem that we've been having, I think, what I'm sort of trying to address here is specifics, okay? Because I think it should be understandable. You know, I mean, a lot of input has come in that says, we have Measure D. Why do we have a paddleboard shop in that area? Okay, is that okay? Is that not okay? How did it get to be approved? You know, that should be transparent. I hear a lot of input saying we're not supposed to have any new for hire vessels, and yet we have two that weren't here 10 years ago. You know, so how did that come to be approved? So I'm just trying to, the primarily I understand, but it's also perhaps a problem in cases. You know, like I said, what if the haul-out facility was to be built on the water side rather than the land side of the Embarcadero? It's going to be storing a lot of pleasure boats. It's going to be hauling out a lot of sailboats, okay? The primary use for that haul-out is probably not going to be for commercial fishing, and yet it's very likely vital to the future of commercial fishing here. So, you know, what does primarily mean exactly? How do we define primarily? Is it if something is of primary importance for the fishing community, does that mean the primarily kicks in? Can we say, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, those are the kind of nuts and bolts issues that I was trying to
bring up so that it's all decided in advance. We don't have to, you know, and it doesn't look like the city is not enforcing or over-enforcing, and, you know, that it's clear what the position is going to be going forward. And I know it's a hard job. I know it's difficult, you know, to sort of parse that, but that's kind of what I was suggesting.
I would agree with Chairman Teft. As I view Measure D, it's not badly written, but there is a typical amount of sort of legal ambiguity, as it is, and particularly with respect to the word primary. We could decide it on a case-by-case basis, so we could start compiling some illustrations that might help us out with that, or some more specific language. But I think that defining primarily really does need some help. You know, there's a few other phrases, though. I'm looking at the first part of it, which says, shall not grant any permit. The use of the word shall and its indications of the future would seem to mean that the provision clearly allowed grandfathering of some sort. I don't have any problem. Well, and I say grandfather because I would find it hard to believe that when they passed the measure, they were actually supporting any sort of wasting of a property asset, and at some time in the future it might change hands and that might invalidate the permit. That strikes me as a little bit extreme. With respect to the notion of by no way of limitations, that seems pretty clear that the illustrations are some things that we explicitly are excluding. But typically the use of limitation means, but it's not limited to that, that there may be other types of activity which we certainly should be at liberty to exclude in the name of the value that we're trying to preserve. And I underscore that it's useful when you look at these sorts of provisions to really sort of ask yourself, well, what were the values or value that the writers were trying to preserve, and clearly they want to do everything to preserve and encourage the fishing industry in Morro Bay. And I can tell you, as someone new to the community, I support those values. In part because I'm just delighted by the fact that we have a fishing industry here that I can look at every day, and because of the economic benefits and the diversity, economic diversity that it provides to the community as well. I think that's all I had to say on it.
Where I think the clarification is needed is not on the obvious things where we have a fishing boat tie-up or we have a offloading facility or we have a adjacent facility that clearly services and is responsible to a aquaculture business. But where the clarification is needed is if we have, you know, if you have one of the original grandfathered fishing vessels or boats for hire that was quote unquote grandfathered in, if they bring in a replacement vessel, is that a new use, or is that a continuation of the existing use? If there is a one of these uses that is under the, you know, say a restaurant or a cafe or a gift shop that was grandfathered in or was existing and it is moved, is that a new use or is that a continuation of an existing use? If you have a dock where there's open slips and open dock space, if there are no fishing boats that are available or willing to tie up there for for lease. Should they be allowed? Should the owner of that dock be allowed to hire that out to a recreational vehicle? I think those, and how would you regulate that so that the fees are low enough for a fishing boat to tie up there if it wanted to, or if that was, you know, because in the instance that the recreational boat is probably going to be able to pay more than a working fishing boat can afford. So how do you prioritize that in a free market system to require that fishing boat is what has the primary use there? These are the instances and the specifics where the language in Measure D doesn't illustrate what our action should be. And I think that is what we should try to work together and find out what the answers are going forward.
I think it's pretty clear what the Measure D says with regarding to recreational boats and as such. And what you're talking about is the economics of it. Now, the economics of, if you're just looking at the dollars and cents, then what one of the issues is isn't just the interpretation, it's the enforcement of Measure D, okay? Or the selective enforcement of Measure D. So what if we are to open up a discussion of that sort, then what you're really doing is rewriting Measure D, and that needs to be put to the people again, because the interpreting, looking at it just from a strictly economic sense, yeah, you know, if you get a sailboat there, or can a fishing vessel, or even the docks, are they set up so a fishing boat can go there? So that invites the conversation of rewriting or putting a ballot to the people and seeing if they want to continue with that.
Well, just to clarify or offer a rebuttal, is if you have a facility there that was economically unviable, or, you know, excuse my wording there, but it was going into default, and the only way it could stay in operation was on a lesser, let's say, you know, they rented out the slips to a recreational boat so that they could afford to be there when a fishing boat was needed it. So is that a consistent use with Measure D? I'm not saying it is, but what I'm saying is that those are the things that we need to be able to clarify. So if the facility would go derelict or would go into default and not be there for the fishing community in the future, where does that fit into Measure D? And this is the gray area that I don't have the answers for, but I think need to be addressed.
If you look at this, the language of primarily for the purposes of serving or facilitating fishing activities, I think the clear reading of that are not attenuated things like having a restaurant that offers some sort of subsidy to the fishing activity. And I think clearly, if the drafters of this contemplated some sort of financial subsidy, or they would have made that more explicit. I think we do ourselves a disservice when we read efforts to not find the language that we'd like to see in it. I think if they had contemplated economic activity of a restaurant nature or a paddleboard rental as sufficient to be called facilitating, they would have put indications into the law to show that, but clearly they didn't. And I think we should look closely at what's there and less so at what's not there.
But by the same token, and I don't want to step on your time, Michael, by the same token, what they did not put in here is anything about grandfathering. I mean, the reality is, okay, these are all lease sites. They're redeveloped on a regular basis. They come for permits to do that redevelopment, and they include these uses which appear not to be for the purposes of serving or facilitating licensed commercial fishing activities. How do we get that concept of approving that permit out of this language?
Well again, I would reference the word shall in a future orientation when they drafted it. And again, going back to I don't think they contemplated wasting those economic resources that were in place at the time. Now, so I don't think they really intended that if a lessee had a pleasure boat, and knowing full well that the lifespan of a pleasure boat is, I don't know, 15 or 20 years or maybe even less, I don't think they, when they drafted this, that they would have contemplated when that boat is no longer seaworthy, that use must disappear. Or
that's a change of equipment, not a change of use. But when a new permit has to be issued, you have to look at the uses that are being applied for and determine whether or not they serve or facilitate the commercial fishing industry, right?
Right.
And if they don't, then, I mean, shall is a very strong word legally. Shall is like, you don't have a choice. I mean, that's like the strongest word, okay? So how do we then say, here's a restaurant, we're going to approve it. Or here's a paddleboard shop, we're going to approve it.
Well, my response would be, if those activities existed at the time that Measure D was put in place, that the measure was only looking to activities after that. I would say that's a continuation of the activity that they originally grandfathered. And I can't find
that in the language, though.
And that's subject to close examination, because clearly a use and that which is permitted can change over time and expand, and certainly I could contemplate where a use that I believe might have been grandfathered in is allowable. I could also come to the conclusion that particular activity had so changed and expanded as not to fall within the parameters of the grandfathering. So I wouldn't, as a blanket endorsement, say, you know, just because somebody had a permit whenever this Measure D was passed, that they can do anything they want.
I guess partially out of ignorance, I'll ask this question, get Eric involved in the conversation. Do we have a waiting list of commercial fishing boats wanting to dock here that don't have access?
Thank you and good evening. thanks for letting me have a word here, and I could probably go on and on, but I'll interject where it's appropriate. We currently have 50 slips for commercial fishing boats per city council direction in the municipal code for commercial boats only. We do have a waiting list. There's probably three or four, maybe five on there at any given time. It goes up and down. But those are only the 50 slips that we operate directly. We also manage the two piers, the North and South T Pier. And we're not the only place commercial boats go. There are a few boats peppered throughout the waterfront, as you've probably seen here and there. But most of them are on our 50 slips. Down at the launch ramp, there's about 20 down there. Between House of Juju Restaurant and Giovanni's Fish Market is another 15 or so. And then just north of Stack's Wine Bar between the South T Pier, that's the last of our slips.
Do we have a certain duration? Is it open-ended? How long the commercial fishermen have access to those spaces?
On an individual basis, there is, as long as they remain qualified, and which entails having licenses and permits and whatnot, and landing a certain amount of catch per year, dollar mm-hmm. basis amount of catch to show minimum commercial fishing activity, they can keep the slip indefinitely so long as they keep up on their slip fees.
Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about slips at a private leaseholder, would you have had any jurisdiction as to the nature of the duration of who they sublease out to the spaces or things like that? Is that does Harbor look at the leases of the seaside of those tidelands properties?
Not to that degree. We do manage both the water. Each site has what's called a land and a water lease, and the mm-hmm. land lease stops at about the top of the development, water lease below that. We don't get into the minutia of who they can rent to or on what basis. It does need, whatever they are renting to, does need to be an approved use of the lease. So if it's not an approved use, then they can't rent to those sorts of folks. But once it's in the lease, they manage that. They're ground leases. They build the buildings. They take all the risk. They put all the investment in, and they need to make it financially feasible. So they choose, you know, like any private investment, they choose the mix of customers that they need to make their business work.
Okay, thanks.
Eric, are you the enforcement agency that represents the city for this? With regards to, like, what with the measure, like a private use, for instance, if somebody has a lease and putting a recreational vehicle there or a recreational boat there, is that under your jurisdiction for enforcement?
Yes, anything under our leases, whether it's an unapproved use or an illegal use or whatever, or not complying with terms and conditions of the lease, be that non-payment of fees or anything. I mean, seeing our leases, they're 100 pages long. There's many things in there that we have to enforce manage over.
And then are you personally, being the harbor director, are you personally responsible for administering as a trustee of the Tidelands grant from the California State Lands Commission?
Personally, as far as...
As your position.
Yeah, I'm just trying to measure my answer. Yes, in conjunction with the city manager, the city council, the city attorney, and everybody else in the city, code enforcement folks involved. It's a team effort. But yes, the primary responsibility for it, where it starts and begins, is with the lease and then spreads out from there.
Okay, but with regards to the Tidelands grant as a trustee from the state lands, does that fall under your jurisdiction or?
It's the city of Morro Bay's responsibility. I, as the harbor director, through my department, are the department that is the one charged with enabling all that legislation.
Eric, let me just be clear. Are you for water leases, which are located within the area covered by Measure D, those are not restricted to, with regard to who those slips are leased to, by the lease agreement?
The lease agreements need to be consistent with Measure D. The lease can't allow or permit something that's not Measure D compliant, or vice versa.
So the lease would say you can only rent slips to commercial fishing boats, or you can only rent slips to commercial fishing and sport fishing vessels.
None of our Measure D leases get that specific, no.
What do they say?
I'd have to pull it out. I don't have that in front of me.
Huh.
Measure D will be basically what the lease agreements will generally say is vessel tie-up. What becomes directive of what the vessel tie-up can be, it becomes Measure D. And Measure D is one of the overarching, really the overarching regulation from Beach Street North, what stipulates what shall and shall not be done. If I may indulge you for a minute, I think I was going to call it the elephant in the room here for a minute, but a few of you started to touch on it. What's been allowed and not allowed in the Measure D area, any law over time gets interpreted, reinterpreted, regardless of what the words are. I mean, things go through courts and go through reinterpretation and look at you know, Roe v. Wade or Second Amendment. There's a law, just because it says certain words, doesn't mean that cannot be open to different interpretations. And those interpretations can change over time. How Measure D has been enacted and enforced and administered over the years has nothing to do with financial cozy deals or allowing one person to do something that another person can't allow. What it really comes down to is economics. When Measure D was enacted back in 1981, there was 180 to 200 commercial fishing boats in Morro Bay. Today there's probably 75, maybe 80. It was a different world. The commercial fishing industry, as it has zigged and zagged over the decades to survive, so has our tenants on the waterfront leases in the Measure D area. They've had to zig and zag. As one of our speakers put it today, so what if a fish taco is sold on this lease site that's in the Measure D area? It's still a fish taco. Our leaseholders have had to financially adapt in order to stay in existence. You can't force a singular use if it isn't financially feasible within the Measure D area. And yeah, 20, 30, 40 years ago, only commercial fishing type activity worked. Today, not so much. Guys have to do other things. They've got to rent kayaks. They've got to do other things. So long as they're primarily for the purposes of, which is how we've tried to administer it to the best of our ability, without driving these guys out of business, because they have a significant amount of investment they put in there. And that investment has to pay off. That investment has to pay for itself. And if it doesn't, either we, the city, need to step in and subsidize it to make it work, or we need to put that infrastructure in ourselves and manage it, which we have not done historically. So it has to financially work for these folks. So we interpret it as best we can, and primarily for the purposes of Morro Bay Landing, the old Verge's sport fishing site, for instance. Started out, you know, back in the 1940s as Verge's sport fishing. It was pretty much only a sport fishing landing, which in the Harbor Advisory Board hearing we had a few years ago, that was one of the questions. Because Measure D says non-commercial recreational fishing. Well, what does non-commercial recreational fishing? And folks that were from that time that had businesses back then, and still have businesses today, clearly stated that sport fishing type businesses were the businesses that were envisioned in Measure D along with commercial fishing. So Verges existed. They had 6, 7, 8 boats back in the day. They're down to very few today, 4 or 5. They're kind of spread along the waterfront for a number of reasons, political and otherwise, that I won't go into. But a new fellow has come in and taken that lease site over, redeveloped it. It needed a desperately needed redevelopment. It took a lot of investment to go in there and build those buildings, build those docks. It's got to financially work. He's looking at his revenues, strictly revenues. The primary amount of his revenues do come from sport fishing landings and his tackle shop there. Yeah, he's got the stand-up paddle guy and the kayak renter there doing some things. He's got some recreational boats there. He's got some sailboats there. But overall, the mix, from a revenue standpoint, is primarily commercial and recreational fishing derived. Go down to Tognazzini's dockside now. That business went through two or three failures before Mr. Tognazzini went in, as primarily was going to be a fish case, need to be Measure D compliant, but had to put some food service on the side. Well, the food service went wildly successful, as you've seen over the years. Started out as a few tables in front, has expanded out beyond that. But nobody can really argue that the majority of his business that goes through there is commercial fishing supporting. It's mostly fish on the menu. Yeah, you have a few other things, but in order to make it work, they've got to financially spread their wings a little bit. That fish dock there, back when I started in the early 90s, was Cordero Winston Fish Companies. It was going gangbusters. We had trawl boats tied up 5, 6, 7 deep on the pier during certain seasons. We had salmon boats 4, 5, 6 deep. The fishing industry's changed dramatically. That dock, Cordero Winston, went out of business. Our commercial fishermen's organization tried to run it for a few years at $1 a year lease. They weren't able to put anything back into the infrastructure, which needs a lot of money for that upkeep of that kind of infrastructure. Then a commercial fisherman came in and ran it for a few years. Fishing industry turned around, started doing a lot better, as we've seen. But still, the commercial industry is under a lot of constraints and restraints and pressure economically and regulatorily. And we have seen some changes. Now we've got Santa Monica Seafood come in. A bigger company's come in, has managed to come in and put a lot of more money and time and effort into that dock, and have finally seen it succeed. But all those uses have had to kind of morph and zig and zag over the years to make it work. So that's kind of the bottom line, and sort of the elephant in the room, is
You know, it's got to work financially. You can't force somebody to stay in business there if it isn't going to financially work. GAFCO, and I'll just use them as an example, their lease site goes over to the South T Pier from where they are at the north end all the way to the South T Pier. They've got nothing from their southern boundary of their building, kind of where the front door is, over to the pier. They've got some plans in the works. But the question becomes, you've got that existing sort of grandfathered use in there. It was a restaurant when Measure D was enacted. That site has been set aside, put away for non-Measure D compliant uses. And in the city either needs to allow that business to keep going, which it has in Measure D. Measure D clearly says, you know, shall hereinafter be considered non-conforming. It didn't say they shall go away. It didn't say no new lease shall ever be established for that site. They just say it can't be expanded or enlarged. Well, you've got to either make it go away and have a concerted effort to do that through your lease management policy and through your operation of these lease sites over the years, or you need to allow that tenant to stay there and invest and reinvest and recoup his investment. Otherwise, you're going to watch him run it down into the ground and it goes away, and then what do you have? And finally, I'll leave you with sort of my final thought is, if GAFCO were to suddenly go away, or Harbor Hut were to suddenly go away, what would come in there and replace it? If we were to go build new slips, you know, that encompasses some of the water, but that doesn't encompass really the land part. It really becomes a supply and demand equation, and we've allowed the private sector to determine what the supply and demand is, and they build and operate what they feel best suits their needs while trying to be compliant with Measure D. So that's my long-winded spiel on how we try and manage Measure D and make it work, and how we've allowed some uses to go in there. You know, the stand-up paddle guy keeps coming as an example, or the bay tour boat. You know, you've got a landing, and he's got mainly commercial recreational passenger for hire boats coming in. Yeah, he's got one of the little bay crew boats coming in and out of there as well. He's got the Chablis in there. All of that mix keeps that operation viable to allow the recreational fishing component to work as well, because it's gotten tougher and tougher for those guys to make it. And without
well,
that up.
Well,
okay, one second. Ahead. So I understand, okay, what you're saying. However, the difference here is, you know, when you say the laws, morph with the times, that's true. But the difference here is with Roe versus Wade, okay, there's a written decision. It's there. It's clear. Everybody understands, okay? What you're telling us now is something that's kind of going on but is not really a policy, is not really written down anywhere. It's a, you know, kind of a, you know, and that's, I think, is part of the, that's what we're trying to address here, you know, and I think that not addressing it, you know, gives the impression, okay, true or untrue, but it has the potential to give the impression that some people are getting sweetheart deals, or, you know, that's why we're trying to make this a little bit more explicit.
And the point I was trying to make with those decisions was, and maybe I didn't use the best one, but the one that popped in my head, a law is put on the books, and it says what it says. And whoever enables it or whoever administers it how they deem that language means them to administer it. If it's getting administered differently than somebody believes it is, whether that's a group of citizens or a business operator or whatever, then it can get challenged in court. Then a court makes a decision, and a court says something. Well, if somebody doesn't like that, it gets appealed to the next court, and it gets appealed to the next court, and that's how laws get administered over the decades. Measure D has never gone that way. There's never been a legislative challenge or a legal challenge against it. Therefore, it's how we've interpreted it is how we've interpreted it, and how we've managed it is how we've managed it. It's not been legally challenged to the point. It's gone to the Harbor Advisory Board, bounced to the City Council, PC a few times, or we've, you know, gotten ideas, we get input, and all that gets mixed into the gumbo, to use Rob Livick's, one of his favorite sayings.
all gets mixed into the gumbo, and we spoon it out as best we can, and if it does get legally challenged, then it gets legally challenged. Or if it goes back to the vote of the people because the council somehow, whether an effort is made to do that, then an effort is made to do that. But until then, all you've got to go on is the words and how they're interpreted and how best we can manage to make it work. Believe me, I don't want to see the commercial fishing industry go away. I work very hard every day in my job, whether it's managing regulatory issues with fish and game or NOAA fisheries or trying to keep that ice house running or whatever. Commercial fishing is hugely important, not just to this city, but to my department and who I am and what we do and how we operate. And trying to keep them in operation is something I try and do every day. I'm certainly not trying to sneak somebody in so we can get some non-measured uses so somebody can make more money out. I'm just trying to keep everybody in operation down there and enable them to make a living and put money back into those facilities so that those Measure D stuff down there can still survive and we get the revenue we need to maintain everything we need.
Right. And, you know, I think what you're saying speaks directly to one of the questions that we had, which is that the way that Measure D is currently interpreted, serving or facilitating does not necessarily imply a direct link, but could be a financial link. In other words, what you're saying is that some measures have been approved because they help to financially support fishing businesses, which are otherwise marginal financially.
Yeah.
Well, yes. That describes the reality that these additional sources of income are needed to make the harbor area in some sense self-sustaining and meet the income goals, I guess, that the city government wants for that. But that's not the meaning of Measure D. So what we have here is perhaps still a majority of the population would very much like to preserve that area according to Measure D, but we have a financial situation in the harbor area that says that really isn't working out very well, and these are two very conflicting.
Well, I don't know that they're conflicting. If this interpretation allows a fishing boat not to be repossessed by the bank, or allows a commercial fishing operation to stay in business, is that not servicing and facilitating?
Well, I would say the larger value, yes, but not the specifics of Measure D. The value, yes, but not the specifics.
I think where we're coming into problem is how do we codify the fact that we give priorities to the fishing industry and the facilitation of the fishing industry without taking it past the point where it all becomes economical. So,
well, that's another very fine line. You say, well, because they sell fish tacos, they can stay in business. But, what if there's six other places selling fish tacos and they want to sell hamburgers. Is that okay? Well, what if there's six other places? Where is, and when you're making those kind of decisions, just kind of, well, that feels right and that doesn't feel right. I think it's a slippery slope. I think, how do you draw that line?
It's not easy, and it's not black and white. Some people have said, hey, Measure D is black and white. Well, it isn't black and white.
No.
What does primarily for the purposes of mean? That's not black and white. That's primarily for the purposes of, and it left it up to some interpretation. Look at Measure D, and I'm hopefully correct. If I'm not, somebody will throw something at me from the audience. But when Measure D was enacted in the early 80s, I believe the slips from Stacks to the South Teeper were there. I'm not sure the second set to the north were there, but they may have been built in later, but you had those slips for commercial boats there. You had the South T Pier. You had Great American Fish Company, which Great American used to have a lease all the way out to the pier's edge, to the inner edge of the pier. They gave that up years ago for a new lease, and when they went to do some redevelopment back in the
I think late 80s, early 90s. You've got Great American, then you've got the stretch between Gaffco and Harbor Hut, which was just one long dock. Now you've seen some more slips built in there, but that was operated by Verge's Sport Fishing. Then you had Harbor Hut, then you had the main part of Verge's and the slips that they had out there and their little landing building and the little finicky fish shop in the back, the boat-shaped fish shop in the back. Where Tognazzini's main restaurant is now, I'm drawing a blank on that restaurant's name.
Duckside One.
Fish Shanty in the back. Non-conforming Fish Shanty restaurant. Krill's, saltwater taffy there in the middle. And then you had the whole fish wharf going with Cordero Winston. And beyond that, it was some other operators before that. And then you had Coast Guard and Harbor Patrol and then Power Plant. So between now and then, really the only thing that's measurably changed in there, Tognazzini's dockside went in. He was required to put in a hoist as part of that to service and facilitate commercial fish unloading. He unloads mostly his customers that want to unload off of his dock, but that is available to other folks if they wish to use it. You still got all our slips in there. You still got the two T-piers there. Gaffco's still there, although they gave up water. Harbor Hut's still there. And you've built in some more slips. Really, all of Morro Bay's landing has built in more slips than Verge's had back in the day. But today's reality of sport fishing, at least with the operators we have in town, isn't as many boats operating as there used to be, and now they're spread all over the waterfront. Well, some of them are operating. Patriot Sport Fishing is operating out of Morro Bay Landing. But you've got Verge's kind of scattered, and they've been semi-homeless for a few years. Operating out of Gaffco's dock for a while. They're operating out of Giovanni's. But that's a business decision that they've made. You can't force them. No, you can only operate out of Morro Bay Landing. They've made a decision to operate elsewhere. So the operator there is trying to balance keeping new development, rebuilding the docks. He went and rebuilt what was largely pretty dilapidated over the years, and now he's got new facility in there, new nice state-of-the-art stuff. Well, that costs a fair amount of money, that investment, so he's got to recoup it. So, yeah, he's still got sport fishing going on, but like I said earlier, he's got to add some other things in there to make it work financially. If the city really intended to eliminate the Gaffcos and the Harbor Huts of the world, then Measure D probably should have been more specific, and the lease management policy over the years, when it was enacted and updated over the years, should have spelled that out and leases entered into such that the leaseholders knew that at the end of the day, they either recoup their investment or they get a new lease and continue to operate. And that was never made clear. So we're stuck with the operators doing what they're doing and trying to make it work.
I disagree. This was made pretty clear. In fact, it's in the municipal code that what's allowed and what's not allowed. And it was laced into the commercial recreational fishing district and the special zone. So, and I'll reference Mooney Code, I think it's 17.24.180. And it pretty clearly states putting recreational fishing boats in there, and it doesn't address the economic issue. It addresses a zoning issue, and if we are to, if you want to change it, and you want to reinterpret it, then I think that is where you have to go. Okay, Measure D isn't economically viable anymore because of whatever reason, then put it to the vote of the people and let them decide. But otherwise, I think we need to, otherwise we have what do we have the codes for? Well, and it looks like, selective enforcement on this and we don't enforce that.
And what I'm, the plain meaning of what I'm hearing, as I understand it, is that given the gradual decline of the fishing industry from the 80s till now, the cities, and by I mean city administrations, expectations of how much of its total revenue should be contributed by the fishing leases, the dock leases, is perhaps unrealistic. And there's a reluctance to acknowledge that, that there's an expectation that a certain percentage of city revenues should come from the leases, but unless certain compromises are made and certain liberal interpretations of Measure D are made, then those revenues won't be forthcoming and those revenues are needed. And I think that's where we are. I think at root, I think that's,
yeah.
And that's
the problem. And I think it may be, you know, I mean, I think that, to me, this avenue of thinking it may be consistent with the written language that's in Measure D, but it's just very vague, okay? In other words, let's say that Eric is no longer the harbor master, okay? And the next guy who comes in his judgment and discretion, decides a McDonald's would be great, you know, to support the fishing. You know, there's nothing that says, right now, there's nothing that says that's going over the line. There's nothing that says where the line is. You know, what is consistent with the language in Measure D and what is not consistent with the language in Measure D. That's, you know, and that's kind of what I'm trying to move towards, you know. And I understand that you made a very good point, Eric, that what this says, what the second sentence says about the existing uses is that they're non-conforming, and the Morro Bay Code doesn't have any provision for retiring non-conforming uses. And I think that's a very good point. I think that's pretty specific in terms of that's where the grandfathering comes from.
It directly relates, I think, and it's always been interpreted that way, because it says non-conforming. That's a section in our zoning code.
Right.
And so it's always been looked at to, okay, what does the nonconforming mean? It has a little bit of extra explanation there where it says shall not be expanded or enlarged, because our actual language in there says essentially you can expand them. So it has a little bit of extra tweak there. And so we've taken, I think, that to heart and have not expanded the 10% that's otherwise allowed by the nonconforming ordinance. But it is something that traditionally the city has looked at and said when they talked about nonconforming, because when this was put in place, we had a nonconforming section in our ordinance, it meant what was in the ordinance.
Right.
So at least that's my belief is how things, you know, how things have been interpreted, you know, to this point anyway.
And see, that makes it much more concrete to say, okay, here's why these businesses have been allowed to remain, and here's the section in Measure D that says that, you know. And with all these other controversies, I think we ought to be able to go through and make that kind of analysis, you know, with regard to financial support that's provided by businesses that would otherwise be inconsistent. That, you know, all of these problem areas, I think we can address them with thought, you know, with...
I'm in complete agreement with that, and I think the added effect it will have is that they will still be confronted with the situation of these lessees trying to eke out a living in a declining industry, and that issue will then be forced to come before city government in terms of we're going to make Measure D much more specific, and we're really going to understand what it means and what it does not permit, and that will ultimately mean certain essential kinds of activities won't be available, and then what do we do to produce the revenues and maintain the wharves and docks? And perhaps that's a good thing, because it will make this economic issue come to the forefront.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think there's the two issues, four issues. The seaside, the land side, the initial leasehold, and then subleasing. And the idea that The seaside seems to be docks. They have leases that are fairly, pun intended, fluid about how long they can be. You know, some boat's going to be there regardless. The land side is more of a commitment to the infrastructure of something more specific. And it seems like if we intended D to be primarily to support the fishing industry, the leases should be written that if you're not primarily supporting the fishing industry, somehow there's some kind of mitigation. And to me, it kind of gets into a priority thing. Do you forfeit your lease if you void the use aspect? Do you have a certain level of mitigation because of economic conditions? You know, I'm thinking like the retail on North Main Street. There's not enough retail demand, so people put housing in it. Okay, well, it seems like if you have an area devoted to commercial fishing industry, that if there's demand, it should be able to have priority. If there is no demand, that doesn't mean it should sit blank waiting. But then the idea of this lease term that, okay, there's no demand now, so we've got a 50-year lease that nothing can come in here for 50 years. It seems like there should be some kind of way to maybe look at the leasehold so the primary concern is still met. If somebody needs to open up a shop to sell whatever for a short-term duration sublease, that's one thing. But to put that in at the expense of somebody who wants to start some, you know, maritime industry seems to be a big mistake. I just don't know where that economic push comes in and where you see that relative to the length of some of these leases that we put out there sometimes. Because the land side is meant to give somebody a long-term lease so that the investment has a possibility of being recouped. But if you've got these specific areas that are specifically about maritime use, then if they don't do the maritime use, what's the mitigation to offset why it's not a maritime use? And that could be something that's periodically reviewed or something like that, but at some point you have to say if it's not a maritime use, is there a maritime use that could come in? So some of it's a matter of keeping the ear about the demand. That's why it's interesting to me. I love to think I support the fishing folks around here, but I have no idea about these numbers at all. That's why it's important to hear we've gone from, you know, 200 boats to 75. That's a staggering thing to think about. So you can't leave 75% of the waterfront assigned to this vacant till that industry builds up. I think it was up here on Surf Street, parts of this were at one point designated to be commercial fishing support too, up on the plateau here, just down the street from us. And I don't know what the demand is for that type of thing. It would seem to be non-existent. But so it's that window of reality versus the nature of leases and subleases, I think, that's kind of a tough problem. Short term, I don't think anybody would have a problem with it. It's when something comes in and long term takes over those sites, I think, is the issue.
It seems to me that they're... Oh, sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
That doesn't change what's written down and what was passed. If that's the issue, then revisit it and write the appropriate language. And I kind of feel that, you know, the this isn't so much a, you know, like overall in the city, it's not a revenue issue, it's a spending issue. So I think that, you know, we can dissect words, but I go back, when I look at this, I go back to the fact that we have not only a responsibility to the fishermen, to the citizen of Morro Bay, but with the Tidelands grant, we have an obligation to every citizen in California. And this is it's a higher level of fiduciary duty, and we need to err on the side of caution. I'll repeat that.
It seems to me that there's maybe a balance here. You know what I'm saying? That I'm going back to this whole issue of sort of non-directly fishing-related
businesses, like the paddleboard, whatever, like, you know, like the relocated Dockside 3 restaurant, which is going to be, you know, it seems to me that there's probably a balance here where it's at some point the financial support that those businesses provide to maritime businesses, to fishing and sport fishing concerns, is a positive thing, okay? And there reaches a point as they become more and more divorced from the harbor, then reaches a point where the change in environment down there becomes more negative than the positive. And it seems to me that might be a principle for saying, okay, how come selling oysters is okay, but selling trinkets is not okay? You see what I'm saying? That you've got a crossover point where it no longer services and facilitates, but it now actually detracts from the commercial fishing. I don't know.
I kind of like that's an interesting concept, actually. I mean, it kind of made me think, you know, something that would detract from it. I mean, all of it, because of how the Tidelands Trust leases are managed, supports commercial fishing, supports just the general function of the harbor, because it's required to. By the way, the money's taken in and what it's used for. It's used to support the harbor department and then maintaining all the facilities that are down there. So it follows along with all of those things. But coming up with something that sort of detracts from, especially in that area, commercial fishing industry, I think that's kind of an interesting concept. It might be something you want to talk about a little more. That seems like some place where you could get in there a little bit with some of the stuff that Eric was talking about.
And thank you, Dr. Sheft. That's a good point. I think I was trying to make that point, but I got somehow off in a whole different track or off in the weeds. That's kind of one of the questions that we sort of try to balance is, okay, if the kayak guys are allowed to put some docks down in, you know, in this little unused corner of the water, how's that taking away from commercial fishing? I'll use GAFCO for an example. GAFCO sits there, like I said, and maybe this was the point I was trying to make, on the existing building site. Well, he can go all the way to the pier, and I'm just saying this hypothetical. If he builds out between his restaurant, between GAFCO and the South T Pier, puts a pancake house, and said pancakes seem to be the popular item for discussion on this. If he puts in a pancake or selling place there, for people walking by on the boardwalk, how is that taking away from commercial fishing? What other commercial fishing use is that competing with for there? Well, we don't have any commercial fishing enterprises knocking on GAFCO's door to put something in there. We don't have them knocking on our door to put something there. So how does that detract? So it's one ad measurement I think we do try to factor in is, how is this taking away? Well, at Morrobay Landing, he's got a sport fishing operator in there. Still not verges the way it used to be, but that's a whole political story in and of itself that doesn't really factor in. He's got a sport fish landing still operating there. He's still got a tackle shop in there. He's added the other stuff in to make it work. Well, how is that taking away from commercial fishing? Because he's added those other things to make it financially work. So I think that's the point I was trying to make, is what was there in 81 and what's still there now. I think largely, a few little mutations, but largely the commercial fishing industry is still being served to the capacity it needs to be served right now. Sure, we could make some things better. We could make some changes. Yeah, I'd love to have a boatyard. That's a whole other question in and of itself. Somebody made the point up here earlier that if we put in a boatyard, the yard itself, probably if it ever ends up going in, is probably going to be across the street, not in the Measure D area, but because it's not a state tidelands grant lease site. But the haul-out place will, and so they're tied at the hip, and it's definitely not going to be a majority of commercial, although maybe they will be, but it's probably going to be more recreational and other boats and a lot of revenue coming from other sources besides commercial fishing, but it's certainly going to facilitate commercial fishing. So is it going to be allowed? And that'll be one of the bigger, if we move forward with that, if it keeps moving forward, that will probably be a pretty good test for bringing on this discussion even further to say, help trying to find what exactly it means.
So, Eric, how do you create mechanisms for when a use changes to the point where it's no longer beneficial to the fishing industry, the maritime industry. How do you create a clawback mechanism? Because you've already had mission creep and lease creep to the point where it's been codified. And it's, you know, they've already put the money out. They've made the investment. How do you justify going back in at, say, 4.5 years afterwards and say, look, we've got a better maritime use for this space? You know, so in the spirit of Measure D, that's, I think, what we need to be able to do is to create a mechanism to go back and say, the priority here for this space should be, you know, maritime use or aquaculture use, rather than a tattoo shop that has naval designs for it. So, you know, how do we do that and still be fair to everybody involved?
It's a great question, and I think it needs to be not just an interpretation of Measure D exercise. It needs to be our lease management policy and our administration of the leases and almost general plan, local coastal plan, all that stuff, all the documentation that oversees the management of our waterfront really needs to be saying and doing the same thing.
You know, the issue isn't distracting from commercial fishing. That's not the issue. The issue is adhering to Measure D. Now, if we want to change it, then change it. But that's kind of a false, because, you know, the example you gave, then anything can be, you know, you put in anything in there. And I think that's where I think we got to kind of focus back in that, you know, we got Measure D, we got zoning law, we got municipal codes. If you want to change them, then let's change them. But in you know, just reinterpreting them, I think it's slippery slope.
You know, one thing I'll just mention, you know, Cal Poly's helped develop this thing called a hothouse downtown, where it's small business development. And, you know, I know the council, tell me if I'm wrong, Scott, when they put the little aquarium site up for proposals, they basically said, we're not going to be looking for the income from that kind of site. You know, maybe what we need to think about is reserving some space within Measure D that's just devoted to being an entrepreneurial hothouse for maritime culture, that somebody develops something, eventually is able to take on a more formal lease. But that would be kind of a form of subsidy, you know. But it's the type of thing, though, that would help grow the kind of thinking that would let people have the legs to maybe take on a full lease of some kind. Because I think you have to decide how important this is to the city or not. You know, as much as I love a lot of our restaurants, do we need another restaurant? You know, and maybe we do. Maybe there's another theme out there. But the idea that this is the only place something like this can happen. You know, we can't have it happen on the sewer site that we reclaim. It can't happen on the site of the power plant. You know, it can't happen on Quintana Road. It's got to happen there. You know, so that's why I think it's a really special place, and we have to really consider how long we block out this exclusivity to not following Measure D. And if it's a few years kind of thing, I think that's something you can live with this kind of long-term continuing to give away long leases, I think is tough.
Well, it's the tough part from the amount of investment that goes into these. They're building million-dollar structures if they're on the land side of things. It takes a long time to amortize that. And so then, you know, you're kind of locking yourself in. You're saying, yep, that's what you're building. And for the most part, the uses sort of come along with that oftentimes. And you're saying, yep, that's okay. Go ahead and do that. And you're putting your stamp on it. The other side of the coin is scorched earth. All these things come up. We say, no, you can't have any more. The authority's in our ordinance. We could literally say, no, that's great. It's not conforming. We're not going to continue it any longer. When the lease sites come up, and we could say no. But then what would be going in there? Nothing. I mean, from what Eric says, we're not having people knocking on our door going, hey, we'd like to bring and put this X use here where GAFCO is or where Harbor Hut is. Those things aren't coming forward. So then you have to be really careful, because if you started getting rid of all of those things, there's a huge impact to the revenue that comes into the department, and it cripples their ability to do the maintenance that's necessary to support everybody down in the Embarcadero, quite frankly. So, I mean, there's way over here and way over here, and you probably need to be somewhere in the middle a little bit.
Yeah, that rationale that it brings funds to the harbor department, which in turn services the fishing industry, is a rationale for putting anything in. I mean, you could put a Costco in with that rationale. So, again, there's got to be a balance, you know. There's got to be a balance point between benefit and what detracts from the maritime readiness, I guess, of the area.
And if you have, this is a really tough thing. So, if you have another restaurant that goes in there, you know, that's perfectly viable, and you know, and paying their lease payments and stuff, and you're using that money to support it. At that point, that space is no longer available to put in a new cannery. That could come in 2 years, if for some reason the fisheries rebound and all of a sudden there's a massive squid haul or something. So there's an opportunity cost that is lost in there too that we have no way of quantifying. So that needs to be looked at also.
I guess I'm repeating myself, but I'd like this measure not to be amended by practicality. I continue to hear that the lessees cannot support both the necessary maintenance and their lease obligations, and they're faced with the choice of stretching the meaning of this provision in order to incorporate some other activity which will meet their responsibilities, or going out of business. And, they don't, and I don't like either of the choices presented. I mean, it seems to me that somewhere in the future we may actually be talking about either reducing the size of the land that is reserved for these fishing activities, or we are talking about in some fashion subsidizing their activities at their current or almost or something close to the space they occupy now, pending the decision of the population if they really, really do value what they purport to value, but may not in reality because of the financial burden it imposes. And again, I'm sympathetic to the speaker who came up earlier and said, you know, things are working so nicely, let's not mess it up, let's not in any sense put it to a vote because we may not get an answer that we don't like. And I guess my response is, that's the beauty and shame of democracy.
You make a very good point, and the question that it brings up is what was the intent when Measure D was passed? Did the people who proposed Measure D anticipate perhaps that there would be areas in that in the Measure D area where land would remain vacant for a period of time until a commercial fishing enterprise came in and proposed a development? That's not to me out of the question. The other question is goes back to the economics. If these ancillary businesses or recreational boat dockings were not allowed, would that not then decrease the value of the lease site so that their lease payments would go down so that maybe then they would be viable without having, you know, in other words, would not if the slips sit empty, okay, because they're too expensive for the commercial fishermen, wouldn't one solution be to decrease the slip rental fees and
you know, would that not make them more accessible to the commercial fishermen that are on the waiting list for the city docks?
Regarding the economics, okay, one of the things that I look at, first of all, you know, if we want to just look at economics, go to Newport Beach, and you can see, oh, everybody's making money there, you know, that way. But it's not Morro Bay what the voters are looking at. What the current situation that we have, the current situation of the health of the ocean, the fishermen, I look at them as having a pulse on what is happening out there. And we can have an integral part of our education and, you know, collaboration. One of the things that I feel that is a huge opportunity for us, a form of subsidy. It's kind of like when they recently I think through the Ocean Protection Council, they had helped some of the crab fishermen with the MOIC acid issue. The other issue is the eelgrass bank. If we there's areas here that we could have the eelgrass bank, we get into that market with the carbon sequestering market, and using that to help keep the balance that what we look at, what Morro Bay is. Yes, we have the restaurants, we have the shops, but then keeping the balance and using those funds to help support the Measure D, spirit of Measure D, and keeping us as a viable fishing community, and using the fishermen to help keep that as a pulse on the health of the ocean, and, you know, moving it forward that way. That's a way, another form of income.
Well, I don't think we're going to reach any conclusions tonight. I think we may have dispelled the idea that Measure D is straightforward on the face of it. The questions regarding the interpretation of Measure D really are the questions involving the totality of the fishing industry and the totality of that end of the harbor. It's not just about the language here. I'm not sure how we move forward. I mean, we're obviously not close to coming to any sort of resolution or interpretation. I think we've aired a lot of the issues.
Can I add a couple more cents here?
Absolutely.
While you have a pause.
Yeah, please.
I spoke earlier about, you know, the commercial fishing industry zigging and zagging, and it's certainly done a lot. It's had its ups and downs. Without going into great detail, you know, we've, similar to the economic crash of 2008, the fishing industry took a similar hit, not just because of the economics, because of regulatory and a whole slew of other reasons. We're now, the weak have not survived. The guys that have strong, that have been strong and managed to make it through the bad times are still doing pretty well. It's not all doom and gloom in the commercial fishing industry. Things are doing a heck of a lot better. The landings here from a dollar standpoint are just about all-time highs. I think last year or year before was all-time high. We're moving away from a high-volume, low-dollar model to a low-volume, high-dollar model. And it's working. The marketing and everything else is starting to kick in. And the commercial fishing industry, yes, it still has some problems here and there, on a number of fronts, but by and large, they're back on their feet and they're surviving and beginning to climb out of the hole and do pretty well. So it's not all decline, and we need to look towards decline and all the space becoming available, because commercial fishing is going to go away. It's definitely not going to go away. I think it's it's going to do better, it's going to do stronger, and it's going to continue to grow, albeit slowly. The second point I wanted to make was another example of success in Measure D. Our farthest north lease site, which is now occupied by Morabay Oyster Company, was occupied by M&M Refrigeration for a lot of decades, and I think it was another machine shop before that, that served primarily, there's that word again, the commercial fishing fleet. Chuck Marcial worked on refrigeration, was a machine shop. He was a commercial fishing boat mechanic and machinist and refrigeration guy, and that's all he did, and dabbled on land a little bit here and there. As things changed, he slowly went in a different direction, and then to make it, had to work more and more on land as the fishing industry changed, and he worked less and less on boats. That lease site is now, Chuck retired, sold the lease site to Neil Maloney, Morabay Oyster Company, and has taken it back to what I would call, very arguably, a much more Measure D compliant lease site. Past years in M&M Refrigeration definitely was not primarily for the purposes of, it was probably primarily for other refrigeration needs uptown, but still served the commercial fishing fleet. He was an important part. I don't want to minimize that. But he wasn't primarily working on boats anymore. And now we're back around to aquaculture, which is commercial fishing. It's considered a commercial fishing industry. And Mr. Maloney is going to take that site, you know, back to more its roots and be more Measure D compliant than it was in the past. So there are successes as well, and there's things that work in the opposite direction. And Neil's a bit of a different example, a very unique example of taking aquaculture that's been happening here since, I think, the 1930s and 1940s and gone up and down in and of itself, and now is doing a heck of a lot better than it used to be doing. I just want to point those two things out.
I would like
it's not all doom and gloom.
I'd like to say, a couple weeks ago, I was walking my dogs down on the Embarcadero, and I guess maybe a squid run had come in or something, and there were 11 humongous 18-wheelers waiting to load up, parked along the Embarcadero waiting to load up. It was impressive, I have to say.
Yeah, that's squid, and that's, we've always had squid out here, but we've never had the facilities to unload. It takes special equipment to unload, and both Giovanni's and San Marcos Seafood have both put in that equipment. So now we're attracting squid unloaders here. So, yeah, that is a fairly recent change, the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, where should we go with this? Obviously, like I say, maybe we should just kind of let it simmer, bring it back in a couple months and discuss it again, get together with the Harbor Advisory Board, have a joint meeting, maybe.
So we still sort of have the issue internally on the staff standpoint that our marching orders are set by the City Council. What that means is we have a work plan. This isn't part of it. I brought it up earlier because of that reason. I mean, so we're not really supposed to be spending time on this right now. Council tells us what to go spend time on. This isn't one of them. We're both running full speed as fast as we can in other directions right now. I mean, we have a general plan LCP update that's about Barry and me. So this is something that probably takes a lot of work on the part of staff time to bring something good back to you to start with, and we don't have the resources at this point probably to throw at that. So that's an unfortunate situation, but it's just the reality of it. We have all these other things we're supposed to be doing. So,
yeah. Scott, then what happens if we get another project comes before us in this vein? How do we judge it?
You're going to be doing like you did for the previous ones that have come before you. It's going to be a decision based on what's put in front of you, and not like you don't do that for most meetings. I think this is an absolutely valid thing to be doing. I think it's a fairly large effort that runs down multiple paths, and I think it involves the Harbor Advisory Board. I think it involves the Planning Commission, clearly. And because it is a fairly significant issue that involves multiple commissions, boards, what have you, it is something the City Council should be telling us whether we should be doing it right now or not.
Right.
And they haven't told us that. And so I'm a little concerned. I mean, I'm concerned about spending, you know, city resource time on it from a staff standpoint on something that that could eat a bunch of it when we're supposed to be doing other things. And then we do one of our updates with what our goals and objectives are, and I'm like, well, we didn't do these five because we were working on this. And they're like, well, where was that on your goals and objectives list? I don't want to have that conversation. So I'm mindful of that. And so I'm going to download much of what was said tonight to the general plan, to Michael Baker International on the side of the general plan and LCP update. I don't know that that's going to get us anywhere if we don't get this on the goals and objectives for the next fiscal year, which is 17-18, which is okay because it's at the end of our general plan and LCP update process. So it's good for them to have this information. It's good for them to understand that this is something that's rolling around out there and been an issue that we have to tackle. So I think it's valuable. And they'll go through, you know, probably the tape on this and take a look at it. And I'm going to ask them sort of their opinion on some of this as well, just to kind of get their take, because they're sort of touching on all things that we do now. So it's
well, I think if nothing else, we've sort of brought some of these issues out into the light. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So that if one of these projects comes forward before we flesh this out more, we will be able to talk openly about, okay, you know, why is this restaurant here? How is that linked to the fishing part of it? What's the contract? You know, what's the provision? You know, what happens if he sells the restaurant 2 years from, you know, and we'll be able to more intelligently explore some of those issues looking at individual applications.
Because the question, though, we don't see it until there's been a lease and somebody's talked about signing for a dollar amount and things like that. So some entity before us has decided somebody's proposal that includes a certain set of uses is already satisfactory. I mean, that's the problem I've always had. You know, short of our, if we reject something because of something that's already been tacitly approved by council in a lease as a use, I mean, how's that happen?
So I'll speak to that. So in the past, we can't commit to, the city can't commit to a course of action until CEQA analysis has been done, which is for construction type projects or redevelopment type project is planning commission and concept level approval. In the past, and I say in the past because we've now changed the way we're doing business, in the past, the harbor department would work with the leaseholder and sort of develop in concept the direction they wanted to go. They come up with a project, and then we take that project and go, here you go, Scott, now make it happen. And then the leaseholder would start going through planning commission and go through that whole process. Well, what was handed to Scott and his department may not have been the most best thing to go forward and may have had all sorts of problems where, not to say a lot of good projects didn't go forward, but it made for kind of a clunky system. In the last couple of years, especially since Scott has gotten on board, we've taken a new approach where I'm getting him involved and his folks involved from the get-go with the leaseholder before we even try to go down that path to make sure that we're in concert. So by the time we get something here, hopefully in this newer model, we've vetted some of these issues and not bringing something that is sort of stillborn or a non-starter to begin with.
We have the same conversations that you had this evening, we have regularly. I mean, there's nothing that was said here tonight that isn't a conversation that Eric and I haven't had probably half a dozen times. We go round and round on this stuff constantly because it's a struggle. You know, it's not, as much as people want to say it's clear, it's not clear. And it's not clear from past practice. I mean, that muddies the water a little bit. How do we get where we're at? Try to figure that out. I mean, we do this a lot on these types of things. And we struggle with it. I mean, it's not simple. You know, so, I mean, which is why I think this is a worthwhile topic. I mean, just because we do struggle with it.
Is it fair to say, given the level of enthusiasm that the commission has displayed for the topic, that we could maybe even eliminate some of the burden on you two gentlemen in the gray areas, just with the notion that when an application comes up in one of these gray areas of what does primarily mean, that there's a good chance that it should come before us and we'll hash it out on a one-by-one basis until we have something more exact to go on.
So when we were dealing with non-conforming uses and continuing those things on, the code even says, hey, you're supposed to tell us through the use permit process whether it's okay or not.
Would that even apply to even something as seemingly trivial as a paddleboard sublease or something like that?
I guess depending on what the situation is, it could potentially.
Mm-hmm.
Just depends.
Yeah. Okay. I think we've run that one through its course. We have no unfinished business. Planning Commissioner comments. Any? Not that we haven't been commenting our little heads off, but.
Okay, Scott, I just have a question. There's been some. We went through the Beach Street specific plan a while back, where the area that way, I think. There's some major construction in the mobile home park. Was that an opportunity to have them conform to the plan to put some screening on Beach Street there?
It was an infrastructure project, so one that we didn't have a discretionary permitting process for.
Okay.
And so we didn't have that opportunity. It was strictly an infrastructure type thing, so a repair and maintenance type thing that you would expect when you have aging infrastructure that has issues. And so that was all done through the Department of Housing and Community Development, HCD, with a little bit of touching base with our Public Works Department for tie-ins to existing city infrastructure.
Okay.
Okay. No one else? Scott, Community Development Director.
A couple things. We do have the sites. We have the mitigated negative declaration released for the Panorama fuel tank site. So that's on the city's website. Community Development Department planning current projects. It's underneath the current projects piece, so that's on there. I only point this out is because it's going to be coming to you in September, likely. Depending on, it's out on a soak right now through the state clearinghouse, and the only reason it wouldn't be going in September is if we get some substantive comments that we have to address, which might happen actually because of what the site is. But that is coming down the pike, and so if you wanted to get a head start on some reading, you could look at that for things that are coming in the future. Also want to note that I think, Chair Teft, you mentioned this. We do have with the utility bill mailer for August, we do have the survey in there. It's related to code enforcement, and it's touching on mostly the locations where you can park and can't park RVs, and then has some hedge height stuff in there as well. That's out there right now, and we also have the survey online. So you can take it online, or you can fill it out by hand and drop it off, because that's what most of the folks have been doing. We have about 260 responses through our SurveyMonkey survey online, and the rest, almost 800, getting you up to almost 800, have come in hand-delivered. And so our intern Ryan is, collating all that. And every time he comes into work, there's a big stack in his inbox. So. Great responses. I mean, it's fantastic to get the kind of input from our citizens, and I'm sure Ryan wishes it was a little less fantastic, but it's great. We're getting great input, and so we're going to be able to dive into that and really, I think, get some good input and direction moving forward for developing those policies, and it'll be a good representation from our population. So I think that's good, and that's all I have.
Okay, very good. With that, then, we will adjourn to our next regular meeting here at the Vets Memorial Building on September 6th, 2016. Thank you very much.